And happy to hi to say to Dave Schwan. How you doing, Schwanaroo?
Hey, good morning there, Elton.
How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. It's warm out finally, even though we've had some rain and some pretty heavy thunderstorms move through overnight.
Yeah, I saw a lot of lightning. The house was shaking last night about 3 or 4.
Yeah, but I'm happy to report warmer temperatures, the 70s, maybe 80. That just changes your whole frame of mind. So yeah, doing good this morning.
A little sticky, though. A little humid.
Humid, and we had some fog.
Oh, yeah.
About an hour and a half ago, it was very foggy down there.
You couldn't even see the Navy Pier Ferris wheel.
Couldn't see anything, yeah.
And how you doing there, Ange? Andy Mazur there?
Doing well, yeah.
Sports
thanks.
World?
Morning.
Well, big week for you, huh, Andy?
No, nothing happened.
Yeah, was there anything going on in sports in Chicago?
No, it was a kind of quiet week. We all took off.
Oh, my gosh. Like you said, we're actually excited now when the Sox win one game in a row.
How about it? No, they won two in a row now.
Woo-hoo!
One more. That's considered a winning streak.
What are they at, 5 now?
5 wins.
Wow.
5-22.
So it looks like Pedro may stick around to May.
Who knows?
We only got a couple days left.
It's such a bad situation over there right now. I don't know any other way to really put it.
Are they still playing? Are they still in the league?
Yeah, they're still in the league. They're actually beating one of the better teams in the league too. The Rays, you know, they're always a contender in the East, and they're about a 500 team right now. But they've lost 2 straight games to the White Sox.
Now I heard this. I don't know if you can validate this for me, but I heard this from someone. Is it true possibly that the White Sox were taken off the sports book boards because they were losing so much that Vegas didn't want? They were getting taken to the, you know,
yeah,
taken to lunch.
Yeah. I can't confirm that. I have not heard that myself, but it would not surprise me.
Wow, that's kind of scary.
I mean, they've had losing streaks of 5, 6, and 7.
And then they win one game, and then they go back on another losing streak. Ashwani, are you a big gambler?
No. No.
That surprises me.
No. No.
Neither
I mean,
am
I've
I.
Had, I've, been to, I've only been to, like, Las Vegas twice. And had fun, but no, I'm not into that.
How about you, Ange?
Occasionally. It's not something I seek out at, you know, a Final Four, one time a Super Bowl.
Right. Are you a prop bettor?
Yeah, I like to do those during the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're more fun. It kind of keeps you, if you don't have a dog in the fight, which the Bears haven't had in a while, it kind of keeps it interesting to watch.
Now, I assume you've been to Wrigley, right? This year?
I have not been this year. No.
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 So is the.
But the book is open, yeah.
Yeah. So is it on. Is it in the stadium or is it just on the premises?
It's attached. You know, remember where the Captain Morgan Club used to be out there on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's where the old box office used to be. Remember
Addison
those
Sheffield.
Days?
Yeah, that's where it is.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of connected.
It's a big green monster attached to the ballpark.
Okay. So there's like 5 feet of space between it, so it's not a part of the, is that the way they get
no,
by?
No, it's actually attached. I mean, I think you can enter through the ballpark, but you can also get in there outside of the park.
Yeah.
And it's got a nice little terrace up top too.
I just remember those days. Schwani will remember this. Remember when we couldn't have the riverboat gambling? You know, they had to have a dock or they had to
pull away
and actually go on a cruise because we couldn't have gambling on our land.
Right.
Now it's in the stadium where the event is taking place.
You knew that was going to change sooner or later.
Yeah, and it's also the same league that has punished Pete Rose for gambling.
Oh, don't even.
That's right.
You know what? I have to share this. So last summer, I went to Cooperstown, and I'm in my own little private protest. I brought a fake rose, an artificial rose, and I went to the hall where all the plaques are, and when no one was looking, I taped a rose onto an empty plaque.
Hmm.
So that was my way to say that Pete Rose belongs in this Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, if you cleared out the Hall of Fame for all the guys that had abrasive personalities and were not really good human beings, there wouldn't be too many left.
Yeah, and there would be nobody left.
Yeah.
There wouldn't even be. Yeah, I mean, and now especially since baseball has embraced gambling, and then with shoeless O'Shaughnessy, I mean, how do you justify that?
You can't. It's really difficult. I mean, obviously every league was getting on board with it. It was big money for. For the NFL, for the NBA, the NHL is involved in it now as well, and it was something, you know, as you guys said, it was inevitable because you know, if it's something that people are doing, behind closed doors, why not make money off of it, right? So that's kind of how it.
Out. The fact is, we have no more. All of our vices are pretty much legal now.
Correct.
Remember the vice? Is there even a vice squad in the police station anymore?
Well, I'm sure there still is.
There's like one person that works in there now.
Yeah. Lonely guy. Lonely job.
So, Shwani, I think that you are really a closet gambler, and I think that
why do you think that?
I think you're on your phone right now. Placing bets if I'm going to even make it through this show.
You are incorrect.
Make it through this show today.
You are incorrect. I'm telling you, you are incorrect.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. When I've gone to Vegas, I have walked right through, like you said, you went two times, right?
I've only been twice in my life.
And did you ever play anything?
Oh, sure.
You did?
Slot machines. But yeah. Other than that, no. I'm not at the blackjack tables or the roulette tables. I will get into a football pool maybe during the Super Bowl, but that's right. It.
Yeah.
That's it.
I have gone to Vegas many times because Elton was there for some residency. So I was in Vegas.
Who's that?
Elton John. He played a residency in Vegas. So I went to Vegas quite a bit over the last 10 or 15, 20 years. And I would walk right through the casino because you have to get to, we have to walk through the casino to get to your elevator, to get to your room. And I would not even put a quarter in a machine. And I thought to myself sometimes while I was at the elevator, there are some people that could not have done that.
No.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? There's no way they couldn't have walked through that entire thing and not put a quarter here or a $5 bet on a roulette number. And I just kind of, I like the bells and whistles, but I'm not a big gambler.
Yeah, my wife's folks live outside of Vegas, so we're there a couple times a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and we stay at a hotel downtown, and actually one of our sponsors, we stay at the Circa downtown, and it's a fantastic property, and it's the same thing. I mean, you have to walk through to get to
right?
to get to breakfast
to anywhere.
To walk through to go, and they have this the swimming pool upstairs with the gambling right there at the pool. You can
at the pool too.
It's a stadium swim. Yeah, it's huge.
Oh.
Yeah. So I mean, I can see that it's a difficult situation for people that need to do it. I get that, and then. This was the first time, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years that we actually sat down at a table. It was the middle of the afternoon. It wasn't very crowded. And we had a blackjack dealer to ourselves, basically, just kind of helping teach my wife how to play properly. And we had a good time. But it was just the two of us and the dealer, and we were learning some stuff, and that was about it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question, though. Gambling now is in the fabric of our culture.
Oh,
there's no question about that. So anyway, we've got a full show today. I hope you will get cozy and comfortable with your favorite beverage, whether it's warm or cold. Find a comfortable seat, and hopefully you'll be with us for the next 3.5 hours or so. Lots planned, so stick with it. Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards this morning. But listen anyway, before we get to Shwani with the far-flung forecast, there's a couple of texts here talking about Pete Rose. I didn't mean to get into a whole Pete Rose kind of discussion, but I understand what some people are saying, especially, I understand the whole Pete Rose controversy, believe me. I was a fan of Pete Rose and still am. The hardest thing to do in baseball is to get a hit, and he's got the most of them, so... It's certainly a conflicted kind of thing. And I understand he bet on baseball, but from all indications, perhaps he didn't bet against the Reds. I understand it. But at this point, I think our society and the sport itself has moved past gambling being this dark cloud over sports. As I said, almost every major sport has embraced it. So I think it might be time to take another look at Pete Rose's situation. But that's another topic. Speaking of other topics, Patrick, hit that little music there, would you? We now go to your favorite part of the Dean Richards Show every Sunday. It's Dave Schwann and his far-flung forecast.
Thank you very much, Elton, and good morning, everyone. Get out your compasses and protractors and newfangled devices. I thought we'd go to a place with a fun title, a fun name for a town today. So, we go to Accident, Maryland.
Accident,
Maryland. And we, that's wow. the name of the town. It goes back to, well, 1786, actually, the first settlement there. Oof. Population of only 338. It's in the far northwest corner of Maryland, in that little triangle-like section of the state of Maryland that juts out toward West Virginia. But a population of 338, and how did the name come about? Well, there's a number of stories on that. The origin, one of the stories says that a person by the name of Brooke Beale and also a man by the name of William Deacons Jr. were friends and conducting separate surveys in the area back in the late 1700s, and by accident, Deacons claimed land already surveyed by Beale, so they kind of met by accident. The name stuck, and if you are a resident of Accident, Maryland, you are known as an accidental.
An accidental!
You are an
nice.
Accidental.
I love that.
So if someone asks you, well, where do you live? Well, I'm an accidental.
Oh my God.
Accident, Maryland has sunny skies, 68 degrees. They're going up to 75 today.
And that's no accident.
And that's no accident.
You know,
that is on purpose.
When you were talking about, I mean, it seemed almost like that made logical sense. That why else would a town be called Accident unless there wasn't some kind of an accident?
That's right, or some sort of an accident. So they met, surveyed the and just met there by accident. Oh yeah, you're surveying here too.
It's so funny how, I mean, think about these people when they were naming these. I mean, what'd you say, 17 something?
1786.
Okay,
or
there's,
so yeah.
Whoever named Accident, Maryland, they didn't think the name was going to stick.
No,
for you know.
No.
Or 200 or 300.
Who knows how many other names were out there like
yeah.
that back then.
So they're like, hey, you know what? What's the difference? I mean, there's only 300 people here. No one's going to... Where'd you say? What corner of the state?
Way in the northwest
yeah,
corner. That,
you know,
that small area that looks like a kind of a triangle in
yeah.
the corner of the state.
They're like, you know what? Another 25, 30 years, someone's going to come by and name it after them and put a burg or a vill after it. So
yeah.
we'll just keep... Accident.
A burg or a vill.
Yeah, you know,
right.
I mean, you know, Schwanieville, Schwanieberg.
How mean, about Accidentville?
Accidentville is, well, I mean, think about how, you know, how many cities, we don't even realize when we hear the names because they become so ubiquitous. Okay, Pittsburgh. It's a burg. It's, I would
yeah.
assume there's some guy named Pitts, right?
Probably, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all these towns, Naperville was named after Naper.
It's named by the person by the name of Naper.
Yeah,
that's
so,
right.
So basically, there wasn't a lot of real creativity when they were naming towns back, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. They just named it after some prominent person and put a, as I said before, a ville or a burg after it. So actually, Accident is kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
How did you find that?
Oh, I was just searching for weird town names, and
is that what you put in Google?
Yeah,
weird
to be
town
honest
names.
With you. Not weird town, but funny names,
yeah.
or humorous names, out of the ordinary, and it's very easy to find, quite honestly. And so, you know, you get lists of from various sources.
Accident.
And that one, I thought to myself, hey, we haven't talked about Accident before.
Accident.
You know, we've done funny names of towns, of course, but
Accident
was a new one. So that's
hilarious.
Hence, that's our far-flung forecast today.
Now, do you, how far in advance do you do the far flung? Like, when do you start flunging?
I'll start looking for next week's today.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And if I know of an historic time that's coming up, you know, very soon, I'll look for a town or a city that's associated with that. So sometimes 2-3 weeks in advance.
Listen to you.
Yeah.
Wow. This is no just little whim with you.
No. No.
Oh, my goodness.
No, and it's fun to do this. It's fun to research these because, you know, you've maybe have been through some of these areas. Did a road trip through Maryland, not
have
far
you,
from Accident.
Have you ever done a road trip to Accident?
No, but I've been close. I've been close. It was no accident that I was close.
I've had a few accidents, but I didn't actually have one
had
there.
Had those too, but not there. Right. Right.
Well, thank you, Shawnee.
You bet.
Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards this morning. But, hey, listen, anyway, we're here till 1 o'clock, as I said, after the news with Dave Schwann and Andy Mazur doing sports. We will do our the regular health segment that Dean does every week with Dr. Jeremy Silvert. It's not really that appropriate today because we've got a very cloudy day, but we're going to talk about the dangers of that sun. As summer approaches, May right around the corner, early in midweek, we turn into May. More hot temperatures. With that comes a nice big sun. The sun has certainly been in the headlines lately due to all this eclipse news. So Dr. Silver thought it would be a good idea just to give people a little brush up. It's been about 6-7 months since we had to deal with hot sun and sunscreens and the dangers of sunburn and melanoma. So we'll talk a little bit about that and give you a little precursor and a little pep talk before the real sun rays come out beginning probably this week sometime. I think Shawnee said it's supposed to be in the 80s, right, Shawnee?
Later. Yeah, not today, but
no, this week, though.
We could see 80s at or near 80 on Wednesday, yeah. Yes.
Jim Toronto with you this morning at WGNRadio.com. Oh, I'm sorry. I do a podcast here at WGN.com, and so I'm always saying that. It's almost like I'm on autopilot. WGN Radio 720 a.m. On the real air this time. And as a usual feature, we have, once again, helping us talk about some health issues, Dr. Jeremy Silver from the... are you there, doctor?
I'm here. Good to talk to you, Jim.
Yeah, I could hear a little... I didn't know if you were okay. I'm hearing a little bumping going on. Medical Director of Emergency Medicine at Northwestern Medicine, Kishwani Hospital. I'm glad you took some time to help us out today. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Jim. I'm actually dialing in here from sunny Florida this time around.
Whoa, really?
That may be the bumping you hear in the background. It's just a slight breeze coming off the water.
Oh, listen to you bragging about the slight breeze coming off the ocean while we're here in Chicago with cloudy skies and rain. My gosh,
it's only a couple of days, I promise.
Where are you in Florida?
We're actually in Orlando for an emergency medicine conference.
Oh, nice. Well, that's not a bad place to have a conference.
No, it's great, and the kids are happy about it, too.
Have you gone to the Magic Kingdom?
Well, that's on the docket. You can't escape it.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much Orlando was created for Disney World. I mean, I don't even know if it was on the map before. If it was, it was kind of like accident Maryland. I mean, nobody even heard of Orlando probably before Disney got there. Well, thank you for taking time out from your vacation. This is a work vacation, right?
Yes, a little fun and a little business, so no problem at all.
Well, it's fitting that we were going to talk a bit about the sun and some of its dangers and some of the things that we could do to keep ourselves safe and prevent some serious illness due to sun exposure, because you're out there. Do you have your number 75 on right now? What are you doing?
Yes. So definitely you're touching on the first very important part of the sunscreen, is that it really should have an SPF rating of 30 or higher, and ideally 65 or higher if you're spending time outside for any significant amount of time.
So, I mean, wow, 65. So at some point when you put that much sunscreen on or that high of a level, are you almost reflecting sun? Is it bouncing off of you onto the person next to you?
It very well could be. I think the important thing to relay about sunscreen, there's sort of the five W's of sunscreen that dermatologists refer to. So the who is the first W, and that's everyone, no matter how dark or light your skin is. People with dark pigmented skin can still...
Uh-oh. I think we lost Dr. Silver. We lost Dr. Silver. I think he just went into the Pirates of the Caribbean. He went down that little dip there. But what he was talking about, and we are talking about here, is the dangers of sun exposure. And one thing I want to ask the doctor is, you know, hey, I've been around the block here, and certainly over the last 15 or 20 years or even 30 years since sunscreen has come back. Oh, doctor, you with us again?
Yeah, sorry, the call must have gotten dropped.
Yeah, tell Mickey Mouse to just wait about 5 minutes and you'll get to him.
Sounds good. I think I was in the middle of the five W's, but basically,
yes.
Any pigmented skin, please wear the sunscreen. You could still burn even with dark skin. And then the when is really important. Every 2 hours, particularly with exercise and if you're sweating, and the where is every part of your body that's exposed, so don't forget the toes. And, of course, the why.
Oh, again. Wow, we're having problems from Florida. Wow. Well, hopefully we can get a better line here. I wasn't aware he was going to be calling from Florida, but, I mean, you'd think that cell phones could get a line from Florida. But one question that I had, and somebody was actually on the text here, was saying from 708, which is a true statement, even though I'm talking about how it being cloudy and everything, the sun is still dangerous when it is cloudy, and you still can get sunburned. A lot of times we get lulled into that, like, oh, it's a cloudy day, I don't need to put any sunscreen on. And then suddenly you wind up after 3 or 4 hours, you're coming to the house, and your face is red, and you say, well, how did that happen? So the sun, a pretty powerful warm star out there that can cut through those clouds. Is he ready again? Are you there, Doctor?
I'm here, Jim.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, tell Daffy Duck to get out of the way now.
Seems to be some kind of cosmic interference here.
Well, you know, ever since that eclipse, everything's going crazy, you know.
There you go.
Yeah, but you said the last W, I think, was you mentioned the interesting thing you said about the wear. Don't forget the toes. That is a great tip. You forget about your toes.
Yeah, it is really important. You know, the famous figure Bob Marley, the reggae musician, died of melanoma, and it was discovered on the base of one of his toes too late. So not to strike fear into everybody's hearts, but it's certainly very important.
Yeah, I mean you always think of your forearms and your hands and obviously your face and your chest and things like that and your thighs and your legs and even the tops of your feet, but I the toes, that's a good one. I don't think I've ever put sunscreen on my toes.
Well, there you go. Get the little piggy toe too, Jim.
Now here's a question, because he went to market, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I have a question here because, you know, once again, it's only been maybe sunscreen has really been a part of the prevention of, you know, of bad sunburn and possibly leading to melanoma and different kind of cancers. What is it, maybe 40 years or so where sunscreen really, was it like in the 80s where we all of a sudden got an epiphany on this?
You know, I don't know the natural history of sunscreen. I do recall, you know, my aunt putting oil on her skin and asking her about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's saying, well, I'm trying to get tanned. So
yeah.
I think sometime in the last 30 years, it became more conventional wisdom that this was maybe important.
Well, that's my point. My point, because I remember as a young kid going out in the yard and putting on oil. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, like some copper tone. It was oil. You know, it was a tanning oil, and you basically were sizzling yourself. And so I'm just wondering, in terms of the possibility of getting cancer somewhere down the line due to sun exposure, is it something that if I was exposed 40 years ago, is that still something that is dangerous to me, even though I'm using sunscreen now?
Yeah, I think that's the worry, is that there can be a long lead time between the exposure and the development of the cancer. The good news is most of the time this stuff is detectable because the skin is, you know, you can see it. And so that's why it's really important, particularly.
Oh, boy. Jeez. We're going to have to. Why don't we take a break here, and we'll have to decide whether we can keep doing this because it's getting kind of crazy. I apologize. Somebody texted, and they said, what's the last W? And I don't know what the last W is, but we keep dropping out here, so we'll have to see what we can do. Patrick, why don't you get ready? You'll hit the break here. Jim Tirano filling in for Dean Richards. We'll be back after this. No switching. Jim Tirano sort of filling in for Dean Richards today. We're having a little technical problems on and off here with our phones. Dr. Jeremy Silver, are you still there?
Jim, I'm here.
No problem. I really apologize for this. It's not your fault. It's something on our end. It sounds like I'm getting a lot of texts here telling me that that people throughout the week have been hearing phone calls dropping through different shows. So it's not your fault. I apologize. I apologize for the choppiness of the conversation, but I appreciate you hanging in there. You know, just for a little continuity sake, we're talking about the dangers of the sun and how to prevent things with sunscreen and other ways, and talking about possibilities of us looking out for potential melanomas and different kinds of ailments that could come from overexposure to the sun. I think it was really important. Could you give those five W's again of when to use the sunscreen?
Yeah, so the first W is why, basically because it prevents cancer. So that's, you know, if just in case, because we didn't kind of overtly mention that. So number one is why. Number two is where. And so you put it all over your body.
Oh, geez. You know what? I think we're going to have to just, the sad part is I've got a lot of phone, I got a lot of guests on the phone today. This could be a very interesting show. I might be tap dancing quite a bit today. Shwani and Andy, I may need you today a little more than usual.
I have a newsroom to run.
Thanks a lot, pal. I'm looking for a life preserver, and Shwani just goes, no, I got to go to the doc. I'll see you. Wow, this is crazy. I mean,
what, is this the third time now? Fourth time it's come.
I mean, I just feel bad because this is getting so crazy here. What we were trying to talk about here in the health segment was, once again, the dangers of overexposure to the sun. We've got the summer here coming. The hot weather will be upon us. And so the doctor was giving us the five W's. He gave it to us one time, but not completely. I think there were basically it was almost like the journalism, the who, what, where, how, you know, those types of things. You know, why? Because it prevents cancer. Where? Put it everywhere. When? I think he said every a couple of hours. And I can't remember the last two here, unfortunately. But
I just looked it up.
Oh, did you? What do we got the other two W's?
So it's who, everyone, no matter what. What, SPF 30 or higher.
Ah, okay.
When, every day, reapply every 2 hours. Where, all skin that's exposed or uncovered. And why, reduce your risk of damage.
Well, listen to Dr. Mazur.
He's got it done.
Wow.
That's Dr. Malpractice to you. Yeah, right.
Meanwhile, Shwani just, I've got a newsroom to run. Look at Andy coming in like the great relief pitcher. The great relief pitcher that he is. I called to the bullpen for the right-hander. Are you right-handed?
Yes.
Yeah, I called for the righty and boom, strikes him out. Three pitches. Yeah, wow. That's the one question that I was having. He sort of answered it halfway there. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, I mean, Shwani, we're around the same age. Andy's a little younger, but didn't you? You're out in the sun with either tanning oil or no kind of protection. We used to get burned all the time.
Going back into the 60s and early 70s, the idea was the lotion that you put on gave you a darker tan. The darker, the better. You know, it wasn't regarded as protection.
Exactly.
It was regarded as something to give you a nice, deep, dark tan for the summer.
And as I said before, that was like literally oil. I mean, you were mm-hmm. using oil to become, a fritter. I mean, that was really the concept. You're laying in the hot sun. It's basically like you're putting yourself, into the fryer at McDonald's. I mean, that was the whole idea. And as I said, I think probably in the 80s is all of a sudden, I think maybe or late 80s, early 90s, when you started to hear more a little bit about the sunscreen. And that's become now a prerequisite. But my fear is I was one of those people that went out there as a kid and even into my teens and 20s without any kind of protection.
Oh, yeah. And we didn't wear anything.
No, so that's the fear.
Went right out and continued to move on. And I know, you know, he was talking when you were able to make a connection with him. He was talking about a long-term effect of this, you know, as you're a younger person, you know, going out and not wearing anything at all. It may take a very, very long time. Maybe decades serious would occur as a result of being exposed to the sun.
But, well, I've actually gone a complete 180. As I said, when I was a young kid, I would be outside playing and playing sports and all the time. But I would go out into the backyard and lay on the green and white plastic chaise lounge. Remember those things?
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, yeah.
with my bad cassette player, and just you know, lay out.
Yeah.
And get. I mean, that was you laid out. That was the term. Yeah. And so that's my. But I remember then as I got a little older, I would see people who did that, you know, throughout their lives. And when they got older, it really wreaked havoc on their face. You know, yep. They had wrinkles and bags. And so even into my early to mid 20s, I was thinking ahead to how old I am now. and so I went almost 180. I rarely go out, and spend a lot of time in the sun. If I do, I do wear sunscreen, but I don't ever go back. I never go out in the yard now and just say, I'm going to go bake for 3 hours like I used to when I was in my 20s. I'm actually happy in that I don't really have any crow's feet, but my skin, I have, you know, kind of a darker skin. But now I'm almost translucent. I'm so white because I haven't had any real type of sun. In a long time. Every so often I will burn, you know, when you go out just, you know, accidentally. There's that word again, Swanee. And so I'm just hoping that the exposure I had when I was in my 20s doesn't hurt me somewhere down the line. That's the hope.
Also, if you are on or near the water in the summertime, the sun reflects off the water, and it could even be more severe.
Well, like
if you're not protected.
Yeah, like someone texted about, you know, the fact that the sun can cut through the clouds.
That's right.
I remember when I was a younger kid, my parents and extended family, we went to Mexico for a vacation in the summer, and the first day out, it was totally cloudy. It was like it is today here. Totally cloudy. There was not even a hint of sun. And me and my cousins, you know, once again, as I said, we were into, you know, going to the beach and laying out in the sun. And we went out and we laid out for a couple of hours in the total cloudiness.
And still got burned.
And came back to the room completely like a beet.
Yeah.
Couldn't even move for 2 days. And it was like, and they're like, well, you know, down here, especially in Mexico, the sun is hotter and it's a different sun. But wow, that was a wake-up call that, yes, even if it is cloudy, you can still get sunburn.
Yes, you can. And, you know, it would affect you really almost year-round also. Not just in the summer, but, you know, the sun being the sun, you can still get some, you know, effects of it. Maybe not as bad, of course, in the winter or the fall, but it still can take its toll on you.
Now, Andy, I noticed you always get a nice little tan.
Yeah, I have darker skin to begin with.
Yeah.
And, you know, ever since marriage, I've been encouraged to put on sunscreen everywhere I go. And I do.
Those wives and their preventive, their helpful advice to us.
And it was also suggested to me, not by her, but by someone else, that you visit the dermatologist yearly for a body scan. So I get a full body scan basically every year.
Oh, do you?
Once a year, yeah.
My wife does that. She's got quite a few moles.
And me too. I was born with a lot of moles.
Yeah, and so she goes every year, and sometimes she's had them removed, and sometimes, you know, they just keep an eye on them. Yeah. It was one thing I wanted to ask the doctor. I think at least once a year, right? You go?
Yeah, I go once a year, I just had a couple removed that were, you know, thankfully benign and nothing to really worry about, but... You know, they look different, you know, obviously when a trained eye is looking at it, as opposed to when you're looking at it, and they say, well, look for changes in the shape and the color and all that. And I see myself every day. It's hard to see
exactly.
That, you know, hard to tell. So yeah, that's why I do that.
I'm more worried now as I'm looking around at my face and some of my hands, I'm worried about age spots more than bad moles. I don't know what that's, because a lot of times freckles is a, you know, is a result of over sun exposure too. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I don't know if I'm just freckling or if I'm getting age spots on my hand. But thankfully, I haven't had any of those kind of, because those, like the moles that you said you've had to get removed.
Yeah.
Do they? I mean, they've actually been like, you know, raised off your skin then, right?
Yeah, a little bit. And some of them are, some of them aren't. I mean, some of them are just what they look concerning to the doctor. And she'll take them right off. It's pretty painless when it's happening. It's a little, you know, a little less painful, painless when it's trying to heal and all that stuff. But
yeah,
I'd rather have that moment of uncomfortability than to leave it on there and find out there was something dangerous.
The hardest thing, I don't know about you, it sounds like you have a regular dermatologist.
Mm-hmm.
It is so hard to get an appointment at a dermatologist today.
Yeah. It's hard to get an appointment anywhere. Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Mm-hmm.
I had an issue, and the doctor said, oh, we'll go see this doctor. And it was 4 months.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, can my issue wait 4 months till this other doctor looks into my case here? Or should I try to find another doctor? And last year I was itching for some reason. And I went and called a dermatologist, and it was like 6 months.
Mm.
And I wound up finding one that was closer to my house that wasn't affiliated with, like, the hospital that I'm with. But wow, I mean, you go on now. My wife just had to change the dermatologist. It's like 4 to 5, 6 months.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
And that, you know, and once you get in, that's the time to make sure you go regularly, because then you're in their system and you're an established patient, and you might be able to get easier appointment ability or availability.
Yeah. Wow. It's a crazy world. I mean, you never think there's a shortage of doctors, but apparently, I mean, I don't know if COVID really, you know, paid a price for us, because it was such a crazy time, and doctors and the whole medical profession was so overcome by that maybe some people, you know, either have changed their mind or whatever. But as I said, I mean, my gosh, when I go on to make an appointment for any kind of a doctor, it's 3 or 4 months ahead. It's incredible. So anyway, well, let me thank you both Dave Schwann and Andy Mazur for coming in here and helping me out here during the health segment. I don't know if we passed on any helpful information, like, as you said, doctor malpractice. But I think at least bringing a little attention to the fact about wearing some sunscreen and being aware of your exposure to the sun as summer approaches is something good. Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards this morning, but listen anyway. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN Radio, 720 AM. This brings back some memories, huh? I think a lot of Bear fans are making their Super Bowl plans, don't you think, Andy?
You might want to pump the brakes on that for a little bit.
Oh, believe me, I've got my foot firmly on the brakes.
Yeah.
But I watched some of the draft, and I don't think the Bear fans are pumping the brakes.
No, they shouldn't be. I mean, this is exciting. You don't see your team, first of all, get the chance to draft two quality players in the first round without having to give up a ton. I mean, that trade that Ryan Poles made last year with Carolina is really stocking the shelves for the Bears right now. And I mean, you get the best quarterback in the draft. You get one of, if not the best, wide receiver in the draft in the first round. And yeah, it's time to celebrate. I mean, but they're young players, and that's the thing that you have to worry about with just, you know, those rookie type mistakes. And the level of competition goes up quite a bit. The speed of the game goes up quite a bit. And you also have to consider that the Bears have never in their history developed a quarterback.
No, they really haven't. I mean, and I should mention that today from 3 to 5, Andy is going to be back with the football analysts extraordinaire, Dan Hampton and Ed Obradovich, for a special extravaganza, correct?
Correct. Yeah, I nicknamed it the extravaganza. Yeah. Just because it fell right. And, you know, if we get two first round picks, it's an extravagant thing. So yeah. That's what we're calling it.
Yeah, no, I don't want to rain on your parade here or take away your thunder from that show. So rather than get into some specifics, I'm sure you guys are going to get way into the weeds
on
that show.
Weeds, yes.
But as an overview,
mm-hmm.
To your point here, what are you expecting? I mean, I know that last year the Texans went from the worst team into the playoffs. There's expectations that, yes, it is possible to mm-hmm. have a rookie quarterback take you into the playoffs and beyond and things like that. You know, Mahomes have certainly...
CJ Stroud did it with the Texans.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So... But at the same time, and this is where I'm from, you have to be realistic. And as you said, you know, in 2017, we were talking about Mitch Trubisky. And in 2021, we were talking about Justin Fields. And now it's 2024. And we've got another it quarterback. And I just wonder if you took the optimism and the hyperbole and the comments that were said about Mitch Trubisky on draft day and Justin Fields on draft day and now Caleb Williams on draft day, it would be the same, don't you think?
Well, I don't know, because Trubisky was a kind of an unknown. He had only made 10 starts in his entire career at North Carolina. For some reason, Ryan Pace decided that he was going to outsmart everybody, including himself, and trade up for a guy that nobody wanted to begin with. And this is what you get. But this guy has been the top of his class for the last 2 years. He was a Heisman Trophy winner. You know, Mitch Trubisky was not even close to being a Heisman Trophy winner.
Yeah.
High-profile program in a high-profile conference before it went under. So I think it's different, and I think that the excitement should be a little bit higher than it would have been for Trubisky because, again, nobody knew who that guy was, to be honest.
But, I mean, Justin, I mean, there was a lot of hype around Justin, and people still didn't want him to be traded, you know, 3 months ago.
Yeah, I get it, and that's kind of where my concern lies with the fact that, you know, Justin Fields came out of Ohio State as a high prospect and a top-rated type of a quarterback, but then you start to think, okay, well, this was college, and Ohio State was always a man amongst boys. It was always they had the most talent on the field all the time. And some teams just could not keep up, you know, for whatever reason. They couldn't recruit well or whatever. So, you know, the next level is always a mystery, even if it's a surefire can't miss. I mean, we've seen a lot of number one picks go by the wayside over the last 25 years that were supposed to be great and didn't. But we've also seen our full fair share of those that were drafted high and number one that went on to win Super Bowls, Peyton Manning. You know, but then for every Peyton Manning, there's a Ryan Leaf and a Jamarcus Russell who never materialized and never amounted to anything. So it's a draft. It's a prospect. I always say this to people in baseball, too, when you talk about all the hype about prospects. And they're prospects for a reason, because they haven't done anything at the major league level or the NFL level yet to prove that they are actual players. So they're prospects. I mean, that you have high hopes, and you think the talent will win out eventually. The thing that concerns me, and I can't wait to get the thoughts of the guys, because, you know, there's a new offensive coordinator, same head coach, but, you know, the thing that right now that Caleb Williams has going for him is they actually decided they were going to supply him with endless amounts of weaponry, and they got Keenan Allen in a trade for a fourth round pick. Veteran wide receivers still have DJ Moore, and now you get Rome Odunze. They added to the backfield with DeAndre Swift. They put some pieces together on the offensive line to help protect him a little bit. So he's coming into a much better situation to begin with than Justin Fields left with. Let's put it to you that way. So that's the part of me that is hopeful.
So do you think in reality, what kind of a grace period does Caleb Williams get in order to make the adjustment? As you said, the NFL is quicker. There's a whole new playbook. There's a whole new, offensive strategy and philosophy. He's a young guy playing with savvy veterans against him on defense. You've got savvy defensive coordinators who will look at his weaknesses and exploit them like they did with Justin Fields. So what kind of a grace period? I mean, you know, Bear fans are starving, but at the same time, so do you think that he gets a grace period or not?
He'll have to get a little bit of a grace period because he's never played in the NFL before. I mean, you know, real fans know that. The hype is real, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of expectations. He's putting a lot of expectations on himself as well.
I read that that you had mentioned earlier that the Bears drafted a punter,
mm-hmm.
and apparently I read that he texted Caleb Williams texted the punter and mm-hmm. said, "You're not going to be punting much this year."
Yeah.
So there's a little arrogance a little confidence.
He was talking about challenging Tom Brady's records already, and he hasn't stepped on an NFL field yet.
Winning more Super Bowls than Tom Brady, right?
So, yeah. I mean, he's a confident kid. You like that about him, and it's turned off some people that he's that confident. But getting to hear some of his commentary at the podium the last couple of days, you kind of understand that he does some of this for effect, but yet he does some of it, I think, to motivate himself and to motivate some of his teammates. But you know, the grace period should be there. I mean, this is again a young quarterback, a young guy that is being thrust into a situation where. You're looked at as the savior of an organization and the savior of a program, and It's sometimes very difficult to live up to that. Sometimes you have to work your way into it. You have to, and you know, a lot of players will tell you, you know, Peyton Manning's first year, they won one game. Troy Aikman's first year, they won one game.
Right.
You have to learn from some of that kind of stuff, too. You have to learn from the adversity and to kind of callus the skin a little bit there and work your way towards what you really want. And again, he's ahead of the curve, though, because of what they've supplied him with.
I just wonder how much patience. I mean, don't forget, there was a lot of potential and a lot of hope for Justin Fields. But yeah. At the end of the day, you know, they won, what, three games over Eberflus's first season,
mm-hmm.
and seven last year. And Justin Fields didn't even win all seven of those games.
No, and he was with them 1 year prior to that with the outgoing regime of what's-his-face.
So I'm just wondering. I mean, I mean you're speaking completely correct. I just mm-hmm. hope that Bear fans,
I think they do,
will have that kind of patience, because there is a chance, as much as you just said, they are stocking him with some offensive weapons. There's a new offensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. There's all those pieces in place. But to your point earlier, he is still a prospect. He is still unproven. And there is no guarantees that the Bears again this year will be 3-14.
Yeah. Their schedule will be a little more favorable because of where they finished in the standings. So that helps quite a bit. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of attention paid to this team, not just because of Caleb Williams, but because of the fact that it was a top 10 defense at the end of the year. Montez Sweat certainly came in and made his presence felt. The linebacking crew that Ryan Poles brought in last year in free agency, Edwards and Edmonds, started to tick in the upward direction as well. I think addition by subtraction with Eddie Jackson gone, you can see Jaquan Brisker and Kyler Gordon extend themselves a little bit. Jalen Johnson is back. So the defense is really healthy and the defense is good. So that is another thing that will help a young quarterback, because it's going to get you on the field more than it's going to keep you off of it, in theory.
Do you think that Eberflus is on the hot seat?
You know, that's an interesting question, because, you know, to my knowledge, he has not been extended. So he's got 1 year left on his earlier deal, which is an interesting point and an interesting situation to bring a young quarterback into as well, because, you know, this is his first introduction into the NFL, and it's going to be the Matt Eberflus regime here.
He is the third losingest coach in Bear history.
Correct.
So my point is, there's no guarantees here. And if there's another, I mean, my question is, once again, let's say the worst happens,
mm-hmm.
and you've got a rookie quarterback and the Bears come in at 4-13, where is Eberflus? How do you justify keeping him, where you want to say, well, we want continuity for the new quarterback, but at the same time, we've got a coach here who's not winning games.
Yeah, my thought on this whole thing, and I don't know anything firsthand knowledge, I'm just kind of looking at it from the outside in. Ryan Poles is a smart guy. Ryan Poles, the GM, knows what he's doing. I mean, I think he's kind of proven that over the last couple of years, that he understands what this team needs and what it doesn't need to move itself forward. That being said, I think he has got a long leash on Eberflus, because you don't get rid of your other quarterback and keep your coach
right
very often.
Right,
that
exactly.
That doesn't happen all that often. So if you're going to bring in a talent like Caleb Williams, you're not going to want to do to him what the previous regime did to Justin Fields, and that's basically change coach, change coordinator, change offense. I mean, you know, to Justin Fields, in fairness to him, he had to learn three offenses in 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, Ohio State's, the Bears, and then the Bears.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not an easy thing to do for a young quarterback who's trying to concentrate on other things and try to get teams to, you know, get a win. Whether or not you're able to do that is another story, but you want to be put into the best position possible to be able to do that, and continuity certainly will help that situation. So I really do believe that even if the worst does happen this year, I think that Eberflus is going to be around. If he survived this whole change and upheaval with the quarterback, and now, you know, Ryan Poles goes out and gets all these shiny new toys for the team to play with, I can't see a situation now where he's gone. I can't.
Yeah, it will be a very interesting season. There's no question
That's
about
true.
That. Over at the other side of this break, Andy, I'd like to talk about the stadium situation.
Oh, you mean the pipe dream?
Yeah, it sounds like we're hopefully on the same on the same page here. And not only the Bears, but also the White Sox, who have the worst one of the worst records in the history of baseball.
The worst record,
yeah, in the history of baseball. I mean, you know, there was some team called the Spiders that they were comparing them to, and yet they want us to pay for a stadium. I just love the gall of this. But we'll be back after this. Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards. No switching. Jim Toronto here with you at WGN Radio, 720 a.m. in the morning. We'll be here till 1 o'clock filling in for Dean Richards. From what I understand, Dino is airborne right now. He's on his way to Los Angeles. I'm not sure who he's interviewing, but it sounds like he's going to be hobnobbing with some celebrity in Los Angeles, and so that's why he wasn't able to call at the beginning of the show and disrupt my schedule. And that's why I'm right on schedule today.
Aha.
It's fantastic.
Well, the phone would have dropped out anyway.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Oh, could you imagine, Dean, if that kept happening to him?
It happens to Dean on the show sometimes during that segment as well, so you're not alone.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk to Andy as well about the stadium talk that we've been having here in the last week. The Bears have been playing this one like a fine symphony. The day before, they know they're going to pick Caleb Williams and get an amazing burst of optimism and excitement for the Bears from their fans. So why not piggyback that with some nice talk about a great new place for Caleb to play in?
Yeah. I mean, the presentation was big.
Talk about a PR. Perfectly done.
I mean, they did a nice job of the presentation. They had all the hype. They had all the necessary videos and the renderings and such.
Right.
And I got to be honest with you. When I looked at the stadium, it's beautiful. I mean, I just don't see it happening. Unfortunately, I mean, that's just the kind of the mindset that I'm in. There's two things that really bother me about it. One was
two.
Two things that came to mind immediately. You looked at all the drawings and all the renderings, and they looked great. I mean, what they did with Soldier Field, they kind of gutted it, but kept the columns up and made it athletic fields and this, that, and the other. There's a bunch of walking paths and things of that nature. Where are people going to park?
I mean, this is, you know, they're talking about access to the campus, to the museum. Parking.
They didn't answer that question.
No, they didn't even approach it. And because they don't have an answer. You know, what kills me is they have all this land in Arlington Heights. You have this open palette.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you want. You could make as much parking. I mean, I've been to Los Angeles, you know, the Chavez Ravine.
Yeah.
I mean, the parking around there
is expansive.
Is amazing.
That's crazy.
You just drive in there and it takes a while to get out, but at least you know that you're parking on the site and you go to the stadium. This looks to me like you are once again making a compromise. You're stuck in a postage stamp spot.
Yep. Shoehorned.
And you're making the best of what you can as opposed to making the best that you can.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference.
And the other thing that hit me immediately when they talked about the public aspect of the stadium and the funding and things of that nature and the park district would be owning it. They want their own stadium.
Right.
What happened to them owning their own stadium? This is the big deal with Soldier Field. Now, look, if they would have done back in 2002 when they gutted Soldier Field and put the alien spaceship inside of it,
right?
Had they have had the foresight to do what they should have done then?
Well, that was a debacle.
Right,
that was a debacle.
Yeah, I mean, they shrunk the capacity down to 61,000, which doesn't even qualify now. Even some cold weather cities are hosting Super Bowls. We saw the Metropolitan, the MetLife Stadium out there in New Jersey host one because they have 75,000 seats.
Yeah.
So that's you know, beside the point. I mean, that's pretty much well known that they were awful on that, and they did a terrible job reconfiguring the stadium. But they want to own it. I mean, the whole thing with the park district was going from turf to grass, and then painted dirt, and then painted grass in December, and grass.
If you pay $2 billion out of your
own
pocket,
stadium.
Yeah, you don't want to own it.
Yeah, and you want to have the revenue from
other
things like the Final Four and Taylor Swift coming back and those kind of things to put into your coffers and not have to split.
But here's the other part of this. I mean, we are the city and this state. I mean, I know we always try to look on the bright side, but we are in a very big financial crisis in this city, in this state. With the migrant issue is taxing this city. The state is still not rebounded completely from the financial havoc that it's in with pensions, everything. The last, now, Andy, you're a sports guy. Maybe I've missed something. The Bears didn't donate the team to the city.
No, they didn't. They had to buy it.
So as far as I know, they're still a publicly owned or privately owned team.
Yep.
And they're for profit.
Yes, they are. That's the whole bottom line on it.
So my question is, why are we, if the Bears can't build their own stadium, then they should get out of the business. If you can't do your business, you know, this is, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf saying, well, look, the only way we can compete is with a new stadium. If that's the case, then you need to sell your team. You cannot, if I run a restaurant and I can't pay my bills, then if I can't compete because I don't have the funds, then my restaurant closes and I get out of the business. Ask people, to, you know, what's happening now is the Bears and the Sox are starting a GoFundMe page. But for the taxpayers.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. In Kansas City, they had a referendum on their ballot during the primary about funding for a new Royals and new Chiefs stadium, and it failed miserably.
Exactly.
And this is a team that won back-to-back Super Bowls in the Kansas City Chiefs. Their interest has never been higher. So now Clark Hunt, the owner of their team, came out today and says that they're going to be split from the Royals and they're going to look independently for their own stadium and their own funding and this and that. Okay, look, the Bears still have Arlington Park.
They still have it, right?
They have the greatest backup plan in the history of the world, right? So this is what they're doing. They're coming to the city, saying, "Look, we wanted to stay in the city, but it didn't work out. So we're going to Arlington Park." That's what's going to happen.
I hope cooler heads prevail. I hope that Governor Pritzker, weighs in here because he's been a little skeptical on this. I mean, you know, Mayor Johnson, he's looking for any kind of positive PR because he's sinking so fast. He just wants to be known as the guy that kept the Bears in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not a good deal for anyone. And as I said before, what bothers me is that that's why I respect the Wirtz family and the Ricketts family in terms of owners in this city, because they have, not only have they brought us the only championships in the last 10 years, but they have paid their own way. They have never come to the taxpayers and asked them to pay for what they did. The United Center, which I understand Jerry Reinsdorf owns half of too, but they, you know, the Wirtz family built that on their own. All these different rinks in the community that they're building it on their own. The Ricketts, they rejuvenated that whole neighborhood on their own dime.
At $18 a beer.
Right. Well, hey, but you know what? I mean, that's then you don't have.
No, I'm saying that. Yeah, it's an indirect way of getting it from the tax.
I mean, there's no question. Well, yeah, but you know that's everywhere. Right. I mean, you know, a Big Mac costs $10 because because now the minimum wage is $15. That's where it comes. I mean, you know, that's what happens if you want, to pay for different things. But my point is, they didn't come to the city looking for a handout.
Right.
Or the taxpayers. And we've got two, once again, as it stands right now, the Sox and the Bears are among, regardless of the optimism you may have for the Bears, right now, the Bears and the Sox are among the worst teams in the city in terms of winning records.
Yeah.
And they're the two that are coming here asking for a free stadium, or at least a partially. And I just, I agree with you. I hope to gosh this is just leverage. Because Arlington Heights is the move. That's the play. That's the smartest thing. And I just pray that cooler political heads prevail here and we don't get caught up in all this excitement for the Bears and the hopes and stuff and just pass this thing, because we will be paying this for the next 100 years.
Yep.
So,
and then they'll want another stadium in between.
Anyway, Jim Toronto with you here at WGN Radio, 7:20 a.m. on a Sunday morning. A little cloudy here today still. Very foggy. Looking behind me at Navy Pier, you cannot see the Ferris wheel. It is that foggy. And it's not that far from down the river from here. So it is a cloudy, foggy day. So stay in the house and listen to the radio here. Be here with you until 1 p.m. Got the music of JT, James Taylor, playing behind me because it just so happens that James Taylor will be at Ravinia this summer in early June for two shows. And I've got Eric Soderstrom, who is the senior artistic producer at Ravinny, to tell us all about the upcoming 2024 season. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jim. Good morning.
Very excited. I should mention a disclaimer. I don't know if you're aware of this. I'll let the people know. But over the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years, I have been a contributing writer to Ravinia Magazine, writing some feature stories and interviews. So I have a very soft spot in my heart for Ravinia.
Oh, well, thank you for those contributions. The magazine is really a sought-after thing. People love reading all of the history of the artists in Ravinia, so thank you for that.
Yeah, no, I enjoy it so much, and even in the very smallest of ways to contribute to a Ravinia season, I'm honored and excited to do that, so I really enjoy that. But So I'd love to talk about some of the shows, and I certainly want you to tell us about all some of the highlights and so many different and diverse genres of music this year, as always, at Ravinia. But I was wondering if you'd give me a little insight, a little inside baseball to how do you go about putting together this massive schedule of performers? How do you decide who to get? How do you decide when to get them? Could you give us a little insight into the process of that?
Absolutely. You know, it's a bit of a balancing act every year. But the great thing about Ravinia is we wipe the slate clean at the end of September, and we get to start fresh as to what do we want to do the next year. And that allows for a lot of creativity, a lot of spontaneity, and it allows us to really focus on our mission primarily, first and foremost. And that mission is to be a reflection of the Chicagoland community that we live in, at least musically. So we start with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They've been coming here almost 90 years consecutively now. And we put together their six-week residency with our chief conductor, Marin Alsop. And then from there, we start to fill in the rest of the programming, whether it be chamber programs or recitals, or artists like you mentioned, James Taylor, or The Roots, or Michael Feinstein, those types of artists. And but it's a two-way street. You know, there are artists that I really would love to have at Ravinia and work on those, but sometimes those artists aren't touring, or they're only touring in the winter months and not the summer months. And the other side of the street is I hear from agents and artists that are touring and that maybe have a special project that they're bringing to the public, and they reach out and ask if we're interested and if it could work in our programming. And then it's putting it all into this massive schedule. You know, it's 100 events in about 100 days. And being able to fit it to one back-to-back like that over and over again gets really, really challenging. There's a lot of fun in that, but there's also a lot of challenge in trying to squeeze it all in. And so that's where we start, at least, is to lean into our mission of being a diverse music festival, our commitment to the Chicago Symphony, and our commitment to the larger Chicagoland community, and then how can we represent that through music.
How long does the process take? Like, for instance, the new season in terms of the wider types of, I mean, I know you've got a couple of shows actually coming up this week. Kurt Elling is going to be in the indoor theater, but in terms of the outdoor pavilion there where most people think of Ravinia, that's going to be starting probably at the beginning of June, right? Late May?
Correct. Yeah, June 7th we start this year.
So yep. when did you start to put this season together? Like, are you starting on next year already?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
We really?
We started on next year, and we're already, yeah, absolutely. You know, it takes quite a bit of runway anymore these days to really let these projects play themselves out and get to a point where everyone is confirmed, whether it's artist or Ravinia or any other one involved, to get get to a confirmation, let alone get to the show itself. So, you know, we're even looking 2 years out because 2026 is the 250th birthday of our nation, and there's going to be a lot of celebrations, of course, around the 4th of July. And so ideas are percolating now for 2026 even. So it's a year to 2 years out oftentimes.
Wow. That's wild. Yeah. So, like I said, I'll let you certainly talk about some of the highlights of this season. But I was intrigued. What if you said there were several acts that were sort of on your wish list? So what I'm just intrigued to see what are some of those? If you had an open palette, you had anyone you could get. Who are some of those wish lists of yours? Those artists.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I've got there's a little bit of some personal pieces in there too that I'd really love to see, just on a personal front.
Yeah.
And then there's some just I know that would be really great for all of our Chicagoland audience. But the first one on the list is Stevie Wonder.
Wow. Yeah.
I've been working on that one for a while. I think it'll happen someday. It's taking a while. He's an artist that, of course, is at a point in his career where he can just really choose when he wants to perform and under what conditions. And so, but I've been working hard on that one. Van Morrison is another one.
Wow. Well, we're tracking, my friend. We're tracking. Yeah. Keep going. I like these names.
You know, Annie Lennox is another one.
Oh, come on. We're 3 for 3. I love Annie.
So, it's not a matter of if with these artists. Oftentimes, it's just a matter of when. And sometimes it takes a while. You know, I mentioned earlier the runway that's required. And sometimes it's just a matter of that, being patient, continuing to try each year. And oftentimes then all the stars align and it happens. But more on a personal front, you know, I'm a big fan of the band Phish.
They were just at the Sphere in Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. I've been a big fan ever since college, and so I'd love to have them here for a weekend of concerts.
You're a nouveau hippie then, huh?
I am. True to the core.
There you go. You love those jam bands, huh?
I do love some of the jam bands for sure. I grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and presented music down there as well. And some of the first bands I ever presented were jam bands. Humphreys McGee, Leftover Salmon, some of those artists. And so that's where I got my start, at least.
My wife and I recently went, just in February, went on a cruise to the Arctic Circle to look for the Northern Lights. And I just constantly get playing their song Farmhouse, Phish's song Farmhouse, because there's a line in there that says, "Have you ever seen the Northern Lights?" And that became my theme song for our trip.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that. And did you get to see the Northern Lights?
Yes, we did. We didn't get to see that whole green sky that you see that is amazing. But we did see nice little, you know, ribbons of green and even some blue, which you don't really get to see all that often. So it was very cool. But I was rocking my Phish song every morning to get me in the mood. I would love to see is the Phish crowd hanging out at Ravinia. Now that would be quite a scene, my friend.
Yeah, what do you think? The lawn would turn into some form of Shakedown Street.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. I mean, yeah, I would love to see the camps that would be starting to form on Green Bay Road up there.
Yeah, exactly. I'm guessing there'll be some burritos for sale.
Yeah, a lot of tie-dye.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe even a couple of tents out in the parking lot.
That's
there.
What
Someone
I mean,
might decide
yeah.
to sleep over.
Oh, I'd love to be on that Metro train that stops right there.
Yeah, well, speaking of the Metro, it's always been a really incredible resource for the festival. You know, you can ride it from anywhere between Ogilvie downtown all the way up to Racine, Wisconsin, and every stop in between. And coming out of the pandemic, our partnership got even deeper with Metro to where your Ravinia concert ticket is also a free round-trip ticket on Metro.
Oh, nice.
and it's become a really nice resource for us, for our audience, and it's getting people to ride the train more than to drive, too. So it takes a few more cars off the roads and off the parking lots, which is nice. So, and that train, for those who don't know, it literally stops at our front door. It is the Ravinia Festival train stop. And so you can get off, and you're right here. So it's a convenient way to get here.
Very cool. Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards this morning. I'm speaking to Eric Soderstrom, who is the senior artistic producer at Ravinia. He is responsible for putting together the immense and diverse musical programming concerts that go on all through the summer, beginning this week or next week, May 7th, right up until what, the end of September, pretty much, right?
Yeah, we go till September 15th.
Yeah,
mid-September.
So lots of music in the air at the classic, historic, and beautiful Ravinia Festival. We'll be back after this message. We will be talking about some of the key acts that you might want to see. Tickets went on sale this Wednesday, so you can gobble them up now and get your picnic baskets ready for a great summer at Ravinia. Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards today. No switching. I'm on the phone with Eric Soderstrom, who is the senior artistic producer at Ravinia Festival out in Highland Park. It is one of the most historic venues, not only in the Chicago area, but in the country, if not the world. It's been host to some of the legends of music, stretching back how many years now, Eric?
120 years.
120 years. I mean, obviously Tony Bennett was there up until recently, until he just passed away. In fact, I saw his last show at Ravinia, but some of the people are like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, right? I mean, these are some of the legends of music in the world have played at Ravinia.
It's an incredible history, and it goes back so far that it takes forever to read through some of the history books here. But, you know, opera was very popular here, continues to be popular, and even artists, Tina Turner, Frank Zappa, Janis Joplin, they all came through here at some point in time, and it just adds to this rich history that we have of presenting live music every summer.
I wanted to ask you about some of the highlights of this year's 2024 season, but I had a text here from 224. They'd love to know when Chicago is coming back to Ravinia. They're always a favorite here, obviously, because of the name, but also because of the great history and the music there. Any hopes that Chicago might come back?
Absolutely. We have a great relationship with them. They were here last year, and my guess is they'll be here probably next summer. 2025.
Cool. Nice. So give us a little quick little rundown of some of the highlights of the season, especially throughout the different musical genres, because as I said, you touch them all. There's jazz, there's pop, there's classical. So just give us a quick little overview of some of the shows that you're most excited about.
Yeah, we've got a great group of Americana music. So whether that's James Taylor, Robert Plant, and Alison Krauss, J.D. McPherson, also Jason Isbell, who is maybe a bit of a newcomer compared to those other names, but really popular in some. I love his songwriting. It is so down-to-earth and authentic that it really resonates with audiences. He's at the end of the summer. Jazz is a big fan favorite at Ravinia. We have, by the luck of the draw in a lot of ways, we have five different jazz artists performing on five different Sundays throughout the summer. So there's no better way to spend your Sunday than to come to Ravinia in the afternoon and relax and have a bite to eat and listen to some jazz. And that starts with Father's Day. We've got two New Orleans big bands doing a traditional battle of the big bands where they're riffing back and forth on stage simultaneously on a program that's hosted and curated by Kurt Elling. Kurt has moved back to Chicago, back to his roots, and so it's nice to have him hosting this evening. And John Clayton, for you jazz lovers out there, John Clayton has written a new original arrangement for these big bands as well. The following Sunday is, speaking of our beloved Tony Bennett, we're going to do a lot of tributes to him over the years, but Michael Feinstein is the first one to come and present a tribute to Tony with access to Tony's charts. His estate has given Michael Feinstein access to all of that music, and Michael is bringing the Carnegie Hall Big Band with him to round out the evening. Let's see, later in July, we have Nora Jones, who just dropped a new album. She'll be with us July 14th, and Chicago's own Mavis Staples is joining Nora on that bill, and Mavis turns 85 years old at Ravinia this summer, which is a really cool thing to share with her.
One of the more intriguing things that interesting pair-ups is the Daryl Hall-Elvis Costello pairing.
Yes, definitely. Those co-bills are really a strength of Ravinia, where we can get two big artists to perform on the same evening. There's a couple others like it with Lyle Lovett and Clint Black and Melissa Etheridge and the Indigo Girls a little later in the summer. But Daryl and Elvis are doing a tour. They're both playing separate sets, but I understand that they've collaborated together in the past on a few songs, and that perhaps maybe they'll even collaborate here at their show at Ravinia.
Yeah, you know, back in the 80s, Elvis Costello had a song called The Only Flame in Town, and Daryl Hall sang backup on that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. So maybe we can get them to play that this summer. We'll see. But that's, you know, that's one of the things that's really powerful at Ravinia, is having these strong co-bills. You know, it's not that often you get to see two artists on the same bill. There's another one with ZZ Top and Lynyrd Skynyrd at the end of the summer. It should be really fun. So
I had no idea, and somebody actually on the text line, 847, they said their first concert was Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. So I didn't know Frank Zappa was at Ravinia. How cool is that?
Oh, that's amazing. I'd love to chat with that person and hear a little bit more about it. But yeah, he was here, and, you know, there were concerts here in, back in the 60s and 70s. This was before Fire Marshal would put capacities on venues, and Ravinia didn't have a capacity limitation. And so people were, it was literally like a Woodstock experience. People were in
crazy.
The trees. Yeah, they were in the neighbors' yards. They were everywhere to catch a glimpse of a concert.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Tell us how to get tickets now for individual shows.
Yeah, tickets are on sale now. There's inventory on every single show. A couple of them are getting really close to selling out. So if you're interested in coming, I encourage you to get those tickets now. But you can go to ravinia.org, www.ravinia.org, create an account there and purchase your tickets. There's tickets is affordable as $17 for Ravinia concerts, and so we try to keep it as accessible as possible. There's even some free tickets you can get at your local library for Ravinia. We hand out several thousand, I think it's up to 50,000 free tickets every year through the libraries and the food pantries and that sort of thing. But
great.
If you really want some of these sought-after tickets, they're on sale now, and I encourage you to pick them up, because four or five of these shows are going to probably sell out here in the next couple of days.
Well, thank you so much. Eric Soderstrom, who is the senior artistic producer at Ravinia Festival, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a great, great time to go out there, and especially to eat the garlic parmesan french fries. So thank you so much.
Another episode for that.
No kidding. Thanks a lot, Eric. I appreciate it. One thing I wanted to talk about, and please always, you are welcome to join into the show. Phone number here is 312-981-7200. You can either call that or text. A lot of people use the text now. I do miss the urge. I mean the immediacy of the call. So by all means, if you want to join in to the conversation, 312-981-7200. In fact, I would like to get your input on something, because I did something over the weekend, last weekend, on both Saturday and Sunday, and it got me thinking. I'm wondering, am I the only crazy person out there doing this anymore? Last weekend was quite a day for my legs. And you say, Jim, what the heck are you talking about? I was standing quite a bit over the last, for 2 days, on Saturday and Sunday. Last Saturday, April 20th, was Record Store Day. And that's become a big, well, I guess a holiday for fans of vinyl records. In this era of digital music, there has been a throwback to vinyl as people are looking for more of a tangible listening experience, something that they could touch and feel and see. And vinyl has filled that void. And a lot of us old people have been around forever saying, hey, we were listening to records when we were growing up. But a whole new generation is experiencing the vinyl revolution. And so Record Store Day was created about maybe 10, 15 years ago, maybe even more, to get people into local record stores again, because there was a while there where before the vinyl explosion, record stores were having a hard time, especially the mom and pop kind of independent record stores. And that was really where the Record Store Day event was centered around, to get people to get back into record stores and buying used or new vinyl albums. And so now it's become a big thing. There's hundreds of specialty releases that are put out just for Record Store Day to make sure that people go there on that day. Most record stores have lines out before the stores even open on Record Store Day. In my area, I have gone to one of the premier vinyl record shops, used record shops, new vinyl record shops, called Val's Hella in Oak Park. It's been there forever. Val unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but the new owners have certainly kept the store going, added to it, and have kept her tradition and love for music alive there.
I'm glad to hear that that has remained open. I'd wondered if it had.
Yes. No, Val's.
So
yeah, Val's Hella.
Away.
Yeah, Val's Hella is it's on Harrison.
Yeah.
Near Ridgeland in Oak Park. It is in the art districts there. And yes, there are new owners. And as I said, they have live music there, a lot of live events with bands playing. They've reconfigured the store a little, and they've built some small stages for people to perform. So they've really tried to not only promote music by recorded music, but also help live music and local and even national artists too. Yeah, have you ever been there, Shawnee?
I did go there. It's been a while. In fact, Val was there the time I had visited a couple of times. You know, because she was very much a present and involved owner at the store.
Oh yeah, no, she was.
No, it's a great place to have gone. And just to add to what you said about touching records and having something in your hand and looking at it rather than just clicking and dragging a file to play. Wasn't it great when you were a kid to know, go to a store, ride your bike into a record store and get a record and, you know, just race home with it to play it?
Oh, it was, I mean, and not only that, you used to have friends come over.
Oh, sure.
And it was like an event.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, hey, I bought the new blank album, and you'd go into the basement and four or five people would be sitting around and you'd be listening to it. And to your point, about, you know, the touching, back then and now, especially now that they're recreating many of the original albums, but, you know, the cover.
And the album covers.
Yeah, the cover art and the gatefold when you'd open it up.
Yep.
That was a major part of an album. It wasn't just a covering. It was an expression of the album itself, of the music. And once we got to CDs especially, all that got shrunk down to almost nothing. You couldn't read, you couldn't see any of the graphics, or you couldn't really.
They had to rethink the design of a booklet for a CD.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the printing was so small. And then we went into the MP3 and then the digital world with Napster and everything, and it just became, music became kind of disposable. And so it's nice to see. Now, what I find interesting too, though, the people that are the great promoters of the vinyl revolution are people like our age, Dave, but It was the people our age who destroyed the vinyl album.
Right.
Because we couldn't wait to sell our vinyl collections and buy the CDs.
And you know, don't you regret in a way getting rid of some of your albums?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I did keep some, but I did sell quite a few. So what I love is people in their 50s and 60s and even 70s saying, "Oh, this is such a great medium," and da da da. And I'm like, "Wait a minute. You are the ones who killed vinyl." You know, it was in the 80s, everybody was selling their entire record collections to replicate them on CD.
We were excited. It was new.
It was a new technology.
The sound, you know, was different. And there were plenty of people in the 80s that did not like the sound.
It was a little sterile sounding.
It has come quite a ways. But yes, once, you know, that wore off, the newness of it. You'd have thought to yourself, wait a minute here, I'm missing something.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly is a warmth to a vinyl album. There's no question about in the sound. But at the same time, being somebody who in college was a DJ at dances, I mean, my gosh, I was still carrying around albums in milk crates to go to these dances.
Sure.
And now when I see these DJs do these things, they don't even have an iPad. They have their phone and they just hit four buttons. And I said, my gosh, we grew muscles because of all the milk cartons that we had to carry with those heavy albums. So there was a convenience side of it too, to the CD. Not only did it have a different sound and a more clearer sound, but there was also the fact that it was smaller. I mean, you know, you could carry 100 CDs in a gym bag as opposed to, having these milk crates of these heavy albums. But so I went to Valhalla on Saturday, last Saturday. I got up at 7 o'clock. I got in line there at 7:30. The line was around the block. There was at least
at that hour.
The store opened at 9, and I was out there at 7:30, and I was around the corner already. I couldn't believe it, and so there I was standing for an hour and a half. And then once I got in there, it was very crowded, and I was in there for another half hour looking at all the different new albums. I went there specifically because there was an Elton John special release of his 1974 album Caribou, which includes The Bitch Is Back and Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. It was a 50th anniversary collection. They added a whole other album with some outtakes and demos, so of course I had to add that to my collection. But I got up early on Saturday and waited in line for and it was a little cold, if you remember, last Saturday morning. So I was out there for about 2 hours on my feet. Then Sunday I went to Columbus, Ohio to see the final show of Bruce Springsteen's current U.S. leg. And so I got up at 4:30 in the morning to get to O'Hare to fly to Columbus. I got to Columbus at 10 o'clock in the morning. I went to the hotel. I was lucky enough to get my room. I freshened up, and then I had the general admission pit tickets. So there's no seats. You have to get in line. It's a great seat. You're right up. You can get right up into right up front of the stage, but you're going to have to put the effort into it. And so I was basically standing from 11 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. I did not really sit down because I had to stay in line. So I was there from 11 till 6 until they let us in. Then I got my spot right in the front, which was fantastic. But now I got there at 6 and the show didn't start till 7:30. There's another hour and a half. And then the show went from about 7:45 until about 10:55. And I was standing there. I couldn't leave my spot. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't leave because if I left, someone would have taken it over. And so, my gosh, I was pretty, that Sunday, I was on my feet almost for 20 hours, if you count the whole time, plus Saturday. And I was just wondering, here I am at this age, and I'm still doing the same things I did when I was like 12. I'm still going to record stores on the first day and buying an album and waiting in the line, or I'm still going to concerts and waiting in line. And I was wondering, am I the only crazy person that's still doing some of these things? I mean, Dave, do you find yourself doing things that you did that you maybe thought you would grow out of at some time, but yet you find yourself at this age still doing them?
Well, kind of, yeah. The record store thing and, you know, things like that. Or concerts, maybe not so much, but, you know, the record store stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
Or going to, you know, going to venues that might not be as crowded as as a big stadium for a concert.
But, I mean, I was sitting there going, my gosh, you know, I used to go to concerts and wait in the lines for the tickets, you know, the night before, because that's what you did. There was no such thing as the internet. There was no StubHub. There was, you know, there was just a Ticketron that was in a Sears, and you had to wait outside at the Sears and wait for, or I used to wait out by the old Rosemont Horizon. I'm dating myself there, to wait out for tickets, and we bring lawn chairs, and here I am at this age, and I'm going, oh my gosh, I'm still doing this stuff. Am I crazy, or is that just what happens? You still love the things you love, I guess.
You sure do. And you know that in a way that's good, because you know you're kind of keeping alive some sort of young spirit.
Yeah, well, hopefully. You know. I'm trying to, but I didn't regret that at all. My legs were killing me when I got back to the room.
I hope you had good shoes.
Oh my gosh, when I got back to the room, I drank about 5 bottles of water and then I collapsed. And because then I had to get up at 5 o'clock to get to the plane to come back home. So, I mean, it was just a crazy time. And there were times where I said, why am I doing this? But then when to your point about staying young or doing things you love, when I was at that concert, I didn't even know my legs hurt.
Sure, you were just having such a good time.
So, so if you've got anything that you have find yourself doing, then it doesn't have to be buying a record or going to a concert. That's kind of in my purview. But if you find anything that you figured that, you know, I did this when I was a kid, you figure you'd grow out of it. But, you know, you find yourself doing it. Give me a call here, 312-981-7200. Thanks for joining me today. Dean Richards is out. I believe he's gallivanting out in Los Angeles, talking to some celebrity, making some movie, I assume. He was airborne at the time of the beginning of the show. When I fill in for Dean, usually he tries to call in if he can, and not only give a little update as to what he's doing, but he also tries to knock me off schedule on purpose. But without Dean calling in today, right on time, my producer today is Patrick Hennessy. He's keeping me right on the board there. I never worked with you before, Patrick, so welcome aboard. I can't hear you. Yes? No? No, I'm not hearing you. You're up. I don't know. Oops. A lot of technical glitches today. Thankfully, this microphone is working. Anyway, I was just looking at some of the texts here, because I was talking about last Saturday, I went to a record store day, got up early and waited out in line for about an hour and a half to get into a record store in Oak Park called Valhalla, which is one of my favorite places to go, and a historic record place, a record store here in the city. But a lot of people texting in, talking about other places too. Yes, talk about Beverly Records on the south side at 116th and Western. Been there as well. Love Beverly Records. They used to have several locations, but I've been to the one at 116th and Western. Believe me, big fan of Beverly Records. Someone else here texts and says that their husband used to get up at 4 a.m. to be first in line at Val's for record store day. Okay, that I'm not going to do. For me, it opened at 9. I got there at 7:30, and I still got in. So I felt that was okay. We were talking about how Dave and I were talking about how you'd listen to albums and buy albums. It was a kind of a communal experience. And maybe now it is again, as more people are getting into vinyl. People said, you remember, he said, I never called them vinyl. Yeah, we used to call them records. We didn't call them vinyl. Today they're pieces of vinyl. We call them records. I got a new album.
I've never owned one, Jim.
You never owned a vinyl record?
I've never owned a vinyl
record. That's Patrick, the producer today. You have never owned a vinyl, still?
CDs, I did. We had CDs when I was growing up, but vinyl, no.
Oh my
gosh.
Never
had one.
Now, if you don't mind, could I ask how old you are?
24.
24, and you have never, and even with this kind of mini, like, do any of your friends buy albums?
Yeah. I have friends who collect them.
Yeah, so you're aware of this vinyl revolution, but it hasn't touched you.
Right.
Wow. You know, I have a jukebox at home that plays, now you might not even know what I'm talking about, but I have a jukebox that plays vinyl 45s. You know what a 45 is?
Mm-mm.
You don't. So
he doesn't know at all.
He doesn't know what a 45.
Records.
Right. So you don't know what I'm talking about.
No.
Okay. So there was an
still the best way to promote a song.
Right. Exactly. So a vinyl album, you know that. That's the big one, right?
Okay.
You've seen the black. Have you seen a vinyl album?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the big one with the small little hole, right?
Right.
It's got five songs on each side. Well, the vinyl 45, it played at 45 revolutions per second, so that's why it's
per minute. 45,
per minute, I'm sorry.
So 45 per second, that'd be pretty fast.
That was the Chipmunks. They had number one albums. And so it was just one song on each side, just one song as opposed to the bigger album, which has like five on each side. And it was just one song. So you bought that, and it was cheaper. It was like, 45 cents, and they got to be a dollar. Well, then they had a jukebox. You know what a jukebox is?
Yeah, I know. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not trying to make fun of you. I'm just trying to get a reference point here, because I don't even know if they make jukeboxes anymore. So they have a jukebox, and then you would just press the number, and it would play the individual song. So this fits right into what you were saying. So like 30 years ago, I was telling this woman that I worked with, a younger woman, that I had a jukebox that plays 45s, and she looked at me like I was from another planet. And she said the same thing Patrick said. She said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, it's the song. It's the one song. It's got the bigger hole. It's a 45. And she said, oh, I saw one of those in a movie. And she said, could you bring one in to work? Could I see it? Like I had a dinosaur bone or something. So it is different.
Bring in a record or bring in the jukebox?
No, a 45. She just never saw a 45 before. She never saw a vinyl 45 record.
Patrick, next time you're working with us on Sunday, let me know. I'll bring in a few samples.
So wild. But anyway, yeah. So a lot of memories about vinyl. That was last week, record store day, and yeah. So my legs were hurting between waiting in line at Valhalla for an hour and a half, and then going to Columbus, Ohio, and standing in line and seeing the concert of Bruce Springsteen for another 12 hours. So it was quite a day. Jim Toronto filling in for Dean Richards on a Sunday. Thanks for listening. I hope you're having a good time. I sure am. We'll be here till 1 o'clock. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN Radio, 720 AM, filling in for Dean Richards today. I was just going to say, there was a woman who had called, and I couldn't get to her call. Kristen, if you wanted to call and talk about Valhalla, feel free to call in right now at 312-981-7200. We can chat about that. I'm sorry that I didn't get to you, but I had to go to the break there. But hopefully, if you want to still talk about that, give me a call. And anyone else, 312-981-7200, if you're interested or you find out something or you have a comment to make about something that we're talking about here today, by all means, give a call or give in a text. On the phone right now, I've got Mick Kaler, who is not only a longtime friend, but a longtime pro in the radio business. He was a radio producer for some of the most popular disc jockeys in Chicago over the last 40 years. He worked with Larry Lujack, Robert Murphy, and then he was at US 99 for several years. And now he actually does some parody songs for the WGN Morning News. So you can hear his work there, too. Welcome to the show, Mick.
Hey, pal. Good to be back with you.
So real quick, because I don't even remember people, you were a fan of Larry Lujack's. What was it like to work with Larry Lujack?
It was incredible, Jim. I mean, I was a fan since I was about 10 or 11 years old and kind of emulated him, and he was kind of my idol. And then when he came recruiting me, long story on that, but just to work with him, it was, what it was like? It was like the kid who grows up loving the New York Yankees, and then one day he's taking batting practice next to Derek Jeter. It's just like, I can't believe this is happening.
Well, that's what I always used to say. I used to kind of the same analogy when I was working with Gary Meyer, because I listened to Stephen Gary from when I was a little kid. Wanted to get into radio because of that. When I wound up working with him, 30 years later, it was, like I said, it the same analogy, only I used Babe Ruth, not Derek Jeter, as a comparison to say, it's like, all of a sudden you're a Yankee fan and Babe Ruth asks you to play catch,
Right. Well, the other thing, too, with Larry from the get-go, and I knew this, I couldn't just be, once I was working with him or for him, I could not just be a fanboy. It was like, no, we're peers. I'm here to help him with the show, and that's the way we kind of approached it and did it. And then, of course, after Larry retired, we were friends right up to his passing, and that was just another crazy story in itself that we became very close even after he's done with his radio days.
Now, before we talk about some of the pop culture news and the pop culture club, I was wondering, I don't know if you heard what I was talking about just before, but last weekend it was kind of like going back 40 years in my life, going out to a record store to buy the record on the first day it was released.
And that was always a big deal, sure.
Yeah, and then waiting in line and going to a concert for 12 hours, sitting outside, and it was kind of a cold, and I had to get on a plane and fly to Columbus and wait, and then come back and get up in the morning and go back, and I was just wondering, as I sat there, as I said, I was thinking to myself, gosh, am I too old for this? Why am I still doing this? Have I grown up? But, you know,
brings you back, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I was just wondering, are there any things that you do that still today that maybe you did, and that isn't to do with concert, I mean, it could be, but anything, but you find yourself going, oh my gosh, I used to do this every day or all the time, and I'm still doing it. You think maybe you would grow out of it, but you haven't?
It's hard to say, but it's funny when you mention the whole concert thing, because think of the way we used to get tickets. Do you remember sleeping out at night at Ticketron? Ticketmaster, Ticketron.
Right, Ticketron. Outside, there was a little, it was usually on like the third or fourth floor of a Sears.
Right, and you'd have to get a Sears, or for me it was a Yorktown Montgomery Wards, and you had to go past the appliance center and the furniture stuff, and in the corner there'd be this little desk, and there'd be Ticketron, and then you would line up and buy your tickets.
Yeah, my first Elton John ticket from 1976 is a Ticketron ticket.
Yeah, same with me. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And a lot of times you'd wait outside, and then they would let you, to your point, they'd let you, because it was usually the tickets would go on sale before the store was open.
Right.
A lot of times, especially on a Saturday. The tickets went on sale at 8 or something, and the store didn't open until 10. And so you'd be out there, you'd get there at like 3 or 4 in the morning, or sometimes even earlier, and you'd, like to your point, you'd be either sitting in a little lawn chair, or you'd just be standing or sitting on the concrete. Then they'd let you in the store, and then you had to like go up the escalators, or as you said, go through the different appliances and the bedding section.
Right.
And my gosh, today, I mean, you hit three little buttons, you know?
Exactly. And the other part about the concert thing, Jim, and I've told, I teach now, so I told my students about this. You know, when you talked about buying the new album, okay, I remember when the Who Are You album came out in 1978, and my friends and I got together in a friend's basement and listened to the whole record, you know, both sides. You had to turn the vinyl over to the other side. That was a communal event. And so when you went to the concert together to go see the Who a few years later, it was the same thing. It's like, hey, we used to listen to this stuff in so-and-so's basement. Now we're going to see them live. It was a whole different feeling than the individual type situation that goes on now.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, maybe it's just the kid in me that's never grown up. But it was funny because when I was in line in Columbus outside the Nationwide Arena, there were people there of all ages. I mean, Springsteen's audience now really spans many decades. There's
several generations.
Yeah, there's the longtime fans like me, and then there's I was talking to two women in front of me who one of them was her first concert ever, her first Springsteen concert ever. Yeah, and yet she was a big fan and she knew all the songs and but this was her first time and I was even. When I was talking to them, they said, well, what was your first concert? And I said, you don't even want to know the first concert that I saw. I mean, in fact, it got so funny because if you remember back in 2016, Bruce Springsteen did a tour where he replayed The River in its entirety, album.
From side to side, yeah.
Yeah, well, that album, though, initially came out in 1980, and that was the tour that I first saw him. I was like, what, maybe, 17 or something? And... Mm-hmm. And that was the first concert I ever saw. It was at the old Rosemont Horizon in November of 1980. So I'm talking to this guy who's like I could tell he's maybe like in his early 50s, right?
Okay.
And he said, so what was the first concert you saw? So I figured I can be a little more relatable to him because we're around the same age, you know? So yeah. I said, well, my first one was the River Tour. And so I'm going on and on about that 1980 River Tour. Because he says
44 years ago.
Yeah, and he says, oh, yeah, you know, the River Tour. Yeah, yeah. But then as we're talking to him, I realize he's talking about the one from 2016.
Right, the more modern day one.
Yeah,
exactly.
The one that was like 8 years ago. I'm talking about the one that was 44 years ago.
And you're like, no, when Clarence Clemens was actually playing sax, okay?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So I was probably about 14, yeah, maybe 14, 15, yeah, but oh my gosh. So I was like, even when I thought I was relating to this guy, I was still older than him, and I was talking about something completely different. But as I said before, once the concert started, I never thought twice, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, then you're into the moment. Well, it's funny you mention that because I was talking to some coworkers one time about seeing Queen in concert, and they thought I meant with the modern-day version with Adam Lambert right. as the lead singer. And I'm like, no. This is back when Freddie Mercury was alive. I saw them twice, okay?
Yeah.
And then they're just like, whoa.
Oh, yeah, oh, I know. I mean, when you tell some people, that's why I said, I don't even mention the years anymore.
Yeah.
And I try to read the room, and I'm like, oh, yeah, well, that tour a few years ago was cool. You know, I don't even want to get into. I mean.
Well, they look at you like you just sat up out of a coffin, right?
Yeah, well, my first Bruce Springsteen album, I mean, I've been an Elton fan since I was 9. I mean, my first record was I bought Crocodile Rock once again on a 45, which
right 45 RPM,
which my producer today Patrick doesn't even know what a 45 is.
Yeah, I heard about that. You have to bring one in and show.
Yeah, I know, but my first Springsteen album was a part of my 13 Columbia House picks for a penny.
Oh yeah, the whole deal where you got—they mailed them out to you after you sent it. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, the Columbia House Record and it was called the Columbia House Record and Tapes Club, and you could order like 13 albums for a penny, and then they overcharged you for the next, you know, 5 albums you bought to make up for the free ones that they gave you. But it was
right, I got their money. Yeah,
but it was an awesome day when that giant box of 13 vinyl albums came to the door. But Born to Run was in my initial, order of 13. Like so, back in the and I was once again I was probably 12 years old or something like that, and so that's how long I've been listening to Springsteen. So it's like I don't even mention that anymore because unless I'm with somebody I know that's in my age group, because I mean they look at you like you're from ancient Egypt.
Like I said, you got to read the room and understand that these are different generations and different. Backstories, you know.
Well, even Patrick here, who I just came to meet the first time here, I think before I mentioned the 45, we were kind of bonding, and now he's looking at me like I'm a Methuselah. Like, wow, this guy is really old. You know, before he was like, hey, how you doing? Nice, we're getting along. And now he's looking at me like, who's the old guy in the room talking on the microphone?
Yeah, there you go.
Is that true or not, Patrick?
I was just thinking, man, it's like I'm with Dean again.
There you go, see?
I feel so sorry for the young people, if you will, because when us oldsters, we start waxing poetic, and, I mean, right over their heads, and it's right. Not your fault. I'm not breaking you here. Somebody texted me like, oh, you shouldn't make fun of Patrick. I'm like, not making fun of him. I'm just trying to explain. I didn't know if he knew what a jukebox was, to be honest with you. I'm not trying to be a
yeah. And again, it's in context, and it's also education too. It's like here's some history for you.
Yeah, but I mean that's crazy stuff. But anyway, so I wanted to talk a little bit on the Pop Culture Club today. You know, why don't I take a quick break? This way we don't have to start and then stop.
Okay.
So get your thoughts ready because I want to talk about, is there too much Taylor?
Ooh, good question.
Too much Taylor right after this. No switching. It's about 10 minutes to 12. I've got Mick Kaler on the phone. We're in the Pop Culture Club. Going to be talking about some of the things going on in our pop culture world. Lots of things on the docket today. As I said, I went to Record Store Day last Saturday, and the day before, Taylor Swift released her new album. In fact, she released,
ended up being a double album.
Yeah, first it was only, the first one was supposed to come out around 11 o'clock our time, and then all of a sudden, like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, boom, the second one came out. 31 songs in total, double album. The Swifties were in Nirvana. And interestingly enough, a couple of days afterward, the New York Times wrote an interesting story bringing up the idea of, are we in an era now of Taylor Swift fatigue? Are we, okay, is there too much Taylor? And I'm just wondering if the Swifties are ready for this. You know, this happens to any artist that gets huge, huge mainstream acceptance. You hit a pinnacle, you know?
Right.
And
they hit a saturation point.
Yeah, and the Swifties have not experienced that yet. They are a very loyal group. There's no question about that. But Taylor is now on a different level. She's in a different, area of fame here. She is ubiquitous. She's everywhere. I mean, by with her romance with Travis Kelce, that put her into a whole different area. Now grandmothers know who she is. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I'm just wondering, are we tired of Taylor?
Well, it depends. Again, to be honest, like you were just saying, how dedicated the Swifties are, I don't think they will ever tire of her, okay? And you're right, the relationship with Travis Kelce has obviously amped things up. There's always been this major attention to whoever her boyfriends are, because, let's be honest, as soon as she breaks off with them, you're going to get a big record with her, you know, talking about all the bad things that happened in that relationship. So I just don't know if they will tire of Taylor Swift. Other people who are on the fringe, whether it's a grandmother or a mother or someone who has a coworker who's a Taylor Swift fan, they may tire of it before anybody else does.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of, you know, I think the internet and social media has changed the tone of fandom as well. It's right, much more intense. You see, even like Britney Spears fans. I mean, Britney Spears hasn't really done much in the last several years. But a couple of years ago, she put out a song with Elton John called "Hold Me Closer," and and it wasn't even that great of a song, to be honest with you. But it didn't matter. The Britney Spears fans just went nuts for this. The song, you know, leapt to the top of the charts and all these downloads because, even though she has not been in the public eye, they are still loyal to her. And to your point, the Swifties, whether Taylor's fame begins to sink with the casual fan, I think that they will be hanging around Taylor just like I've been hanging around Bruce Springsteen. They will see her through another breakup or a marriage and motherhood and old age.
Well, yeah, exactly. Now, just to put it in perspective, Jim, as far as those dedicated fans, when Taylor played last summer at Soldier Field, you heard about the girls, the young women who were coming to the concert wearing adult diapers, right?
No.
There were women there who went to the show, and they're getting into their seats, and they were so afraid of missing any 2 minutes of her 3-hour, 15-minute show that they wore adult diapers in case they had to use the bathroom because they didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
Now, Jim, you know I love Elton John. I love Bruce Springsteen. Hey, there have been a couple times when Bruce was playing, you know, Thunder Road, and Nature Called, and I had to go use the bathroom,
right,
okay?
Exactly. Well, like so I said, when I went...
That's how dedicated many of them are. And getting back to the concert thing, there's a woman I know, her daughter got tickets, I think it was like a year ahead of time for a show that's coming up this year in the United States. That's how far in advance people are planning and plotting and getting these things ready to go see Taylor Swift in concert.
Well, what's so funny was, so when I was in the line for Record Store Day last week, there were three young women in front of me, probably in their early to mid-20s, and the owner of the store came out and asked everybody in line just to keep people, you know, kind of interested because it was like, you know, we've been waiting in line. Some people were there from midnight the night before.
Right.
Outside of this record store. That's no lie.
Wanted to get the good stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
Because there's, you know, sometimes there's only one copy of a specific album. So you want to get there. And so, but what I found interesting was these three girls, women, they asked the guy, he said, "Why are you here?" They said, "Oh, Taylor." You know, one word, Taylor. just Taylor. You know what we're talking about. And they said, yeah, Taylor. And I was like, wow, why are you waiting in this line? That album is released at the stores. You know, it wasn't a record store day release. It was just a regular release. But then I found up as I was eavesdropping on them for an hour and a half because I had nothing better to do. Apparently, there was a special letter that came with the album or something.
Oh, a special edition type thing.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's why they were there. And when when the doors opened, we didn't get right in. In the first rush of people, we were almost in the first rush from where I was in line. And so these three women were like, you know, the record store has these big, you know, windows in the front, and there's posters all over the windows, but there's little openings in between the posters. And once the people got in to start buying the records, they were looking through the little spaces between the posters and going, oh, okay, wait a minute. You see to the right? I think that's where the Taylor albums are. And oh, my gosh, wait. Oh, my God. That girl over there, she just bought one. Oh, my gosh. You know, they were trying, okay, when we go in, and they wanted to buy some Olivia Rodrigo albums. They had these other albums, and they went on their phones, and they said, well, what does that album cover look like? Oh, I don't know. And then they looked it up on their phone to show it. So it's like they all scattered to different parts of the store.
Yeah.
To get certain things. And so I said, well, this is what that album looks like, and this is what this album looks like, and the Taylor album's over there, so we got to go right over there. And they were, like, plotting their strategy. And I was just like, I'm just going to go to the J section. I'm going to get the Elton album, and I'm going to leave. You know,
move out of my way and just stay out of their way, right?
And the good thing is that now that, you know, like, say, 10 years ago, the Elton albums were in a lot more demand, but now, you know, he's 10 years older, and there was like 7 copies. I had no problem getting one.
Yeah, you're on your own as far as that goes. Exactly. Well, it's funny you mention all that stuff because I heard this week that in one of Taylor's new songs, she mentions the word dazzling, and there is speculation that she's going to play Dazzler in the next Avengers movie.
Oh, okay? Boy. Yeah, she's very good at dropping
all sorts of things. And, of course, obviously with the song lyrics, believe me, Jim, These Swifties, they are deciphering this stuff like it's you know, the lost treasure of Inca, whatever, as far as what Taylor means in each song, and they're just that fanatic. That's just how much they're into her.
I've got some friends who have 2 daughters. They're both, I think they're 25, and they're huge Swiftie fans. I've actually had them on the air here talking about Taylor last summer because they went to the concert. And I was texting back and forth with one of them, and she said, I'm going to have to go online and look up some references because there's a lot of mythology and theology references in some of these songs that I have to look them up to see what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they dive deep into the lyrics.
It's like
and,
detective work they have to do to interpret some of this stuff.
And hey,
you know?
and there's nothing wrong with that. Like I said, I do the same thing. I love my lyrics. I love my songs. I love my artists. So there's nothing quite like when an album, when your favorite artist comes out with a new album. But it will be interesting to see if Taylor can keep this up. We will find out. Mick, we were just talking about Swifties. And right. If we would get, and if there's a possibility now that Taylor has gotten so popular that we are under Taylor fatigue, no surprise to see that the album, her album debuted at number one. Interesting to see how long it stays at number one.
Right, yeah, see what kind of staying power there is as far as the long-term situation goes.
Yeah, but there's no question, as I said, she's in a different stratosphere, and so Swifties are going to have to get used to people talking bad about her for the first time.
She got booed at the NFL draft in Detroit when her name was brought up when she came out.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the reason there, obviously, is because of her association with Travis Kelce and the world champion Kansas City Chiefs. I think it was more for that.
Right.
But again, there are some people that are going to be like, hey, I'm not into her music and I don't like the Chiefs, so there you go.
Well, it's similar. I mean, think back to the mid-'80s when Michael Jackson and Thriller was so popular. Michael Jackson was everywhere. People loved Michael Jackson, but then there was a Michael Jackson fatigue, and people revolted against hearing Michael Jackson so much because it was everywhere, and he was everywhere. He was on every news station, every newspaper, in the Inquirer, in Time Magazine, on the news, in the radio, on MTV, and there just becomes a saturation point. So it will be interesting to see in today's social media world if there's even such a thing as saturation, though. I don't know.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see for sure.
So here's an interesting, I guess, phenomenon. It made breaking news when it happened. But at the same time, it didn't have as much staying power as a topic. And I felt like it sort of came and went. And once again, in today's pop culture, very few stories have legs for very. We are a very disposable culture, but
right, everything has very minimal staying power.
Yeah, but I was surprised that more was not discussed in depth when the death of O.J. Simpson was announced.
You know, that's a great point because I think about 2 days after his death, I had seen like there was obviously some coverage, but after that, it was kind of put away, like it was just locked up. And we've heard since then that he's been cremated, and then that's done. But you're right, that story did not have legs as far as his passing goes.
And, you know, I mean, when it broke, it was everywhere. O.J. Simpson died at 76. But I was surprised there wasn't more discussion, because I really believe, look, this country has been divided for years. If you think that the country's only been divided in the last 10 or 15 years, you really haven't been paying attention. I mean, let's be honest. In terms of race, this country was founded on a racial divide.
Sure. You know,
I mean, the Constitution is basically a compromise between the North and the South, between slavery and not. And then, obviously, less than 100 years later, we had a civil war over the subject. So we've been divided on race even leading up to our founding. But we just haven't been divided on race. But if you think about the O.J. Simpson saga, and I mean the murders and then the trial in 94 and in 95, that really was a turning point, I think. We are feeling the repercussions of that racial divide from 30 years ago, even today. I really believe that was a pivotal point in our culture because we saw the differences on national television where the races stood.
Right, and the trial was daily, so people who were into it, and I was when I was working in radio, I was able to watch it every day because I was home by that time each morning to watch the trial. And again, everybody chose their side and chose which part of the evidence and the situations and the strategies that they agreed with. And again, it was a big racial split there.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it was a soap opera. It was. If you think about it, it was reality TV in its most purest sense. Even before Survivor, which sort of is responsible for, in many ways, kicking off at least in a wide scope, the reality TV phenomenon. But that was about in 2000. You know, the O.J. Simpson trial was 1995, and this was real life. This was not scripted. This was not fake. This was reality television in its purest sense.
And the other part of it was, it was intense. I mean, if you think of it, especially when it started in January of 95 until early October, that was the lead story in the news every day, even on weekends. What are the jurors doing because they're sequestered? It was just the most intense follow-up as far as the story goes. Name me another story that happened in 95 outside of maybe the great Chicago heat wave, which was 4 days in July. Other than that, nationwide, that was it. It was what everybody was focused on.
And not only are we feeling the influence and the repercussions of the trial and what it did to us on a racial basis, but then also remember, as you said, it was on every day, and that really gave validity, not birth, because CNN had been around in the late 70s and early 80s, but when that trial was televised, it elevated the 24-hour all-cable news news cycle and made and it validated CNN. It put them on the map, and it also then gave birth to other media companies saying, well, wait a minute, if CNN could do that and get these kind of ratings, why can't we? And so then we saw the birth later of Fox and MSNBC and CNBC and other kind of 24-hour news networks, which certainly have had an impact on, once again, the culture and the division in this country. So once again, it was the O.J. Simpson trial that that impacted our television viewing as well.
Right. And there was the whole thing about, you know, every news channel finding the experts who knew everything, you know, legal-wise and forensics-wise and all those things. And that's something that now transcends beyond the O.J. situation. It can go all the way up to the Donald Trump trial that's going on now. It's let's find the experts who can tell us what's really going on. And it's a very, like you said, intense, dig-deep situation.
And not only that, but then, okay, so look at the racial divide that it created. Look at the media influence it had, but then also look at in especially in today's world even more. Now, don't forget, this was the internet was around in 94 and 95, but it didn't have the impact that it has today. There was no social
right,
media.
Didn't have access to it on their phones.
No,
like
there
that.
Was no
a whole
yeah
different situation.
Yeah, the smartphone didn't come around till 2007. So and while people were in 95 were just getting used to email, you
right
know, but think about all of the instant, now we would call them viral celebrities, but think about all the celebrities that were created because instant or, and they didn't last, but the flash of fame, these instant celebrities, which is now a part of our culture, that really got born out of the O.J. Simpson saga. You had people like Cato Kalin and Judge Ito and Faye Resnick. And A.C. Collins, and all these people that were these side players, and of course, you know, F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran, and then an unknown lawyer named Robert Kardashian.
Right, and look what that bred later on, exactly.
Who gave birth to the reality television world with his offspring.
Yep.
So I was just surprised that, like you said, after a couple of days, this O.J. Simpson story just left. And I'm like, my gosh, there are so many moments here. And also, as we were talking before, they were teaching moments. There might be young people. Don't forget, this is O.J. The murders are coming up on almost 30 years ago. I think they were in June of 94.
Right.
So that's 30 years ago. So there's a good, there's a whole generation and a half now that only know O.J. from reading a story or going online, but they didn't experience like a good part of the population did. And so I was surprised there wasn't more rehashing of that, of the remembrances of it, as well as a teaching from a historical background to people that weren't there to understand the full breadth of it.
Well, I think part of that also has to do with, as you just said, Jim, that we have this 24-hour news cycle, okay? So a couple days after O.J.'s gone, because so many people, like you said, generation-wise, it's almost 30 years ago that the murders happened and the trial and all that, it's, okay, that was history, what's happening tomorrow? And that's what a lot of people look at, especially younger people. A lot of them don't even have interest in what happened 10 years ago. And I'm not trying to sound like an old fuddy-duddy with that, but it's just a fact. And O.J. was just kind of out of the spotlight outside of that jail time he did do for a few years in Las Vegas for trying to get some of the materials back. But by then, it was just a minor issue as opposed to that murder trial.
Yeah, and I mean, and then look, I mean, you know, once again, I remember being, I was working in an office at the time. The verdict was announced at noon our time. It was 10 o'clock in California. We ordered a pizza and sat in my boss's office.
His appointment television, yeah.
To watch the verdict. And when the verdict was announced and he got not guilty, and they showed the two sides where you saw African Americans cheering and white people kind of in shock, our racial divide was broadcast on live television. And let's not forget,
right,
you know, that trial was drama, it was theater. And it, you know, it also had the ingredients of a racial component, because look, how many years, you know, we know about the Emmett Till you know, situation where people, white people killed Emmett Till, 14-year-old kid in Mississippi, for supposedly whistling at a white woman, and his mom brought him back home to Chicago to show the carnage that these people did. And those people that killed Emmett Till were found not guilty.
Right.
You know, we have seen throughout our history here that you know, white people killing black people, and the white people have gotten off. So this was a chance, whether it was right or wrong, whether people felt he was guilty or not. When you looked at it from the African Americans' perspective, they were saying, you know what, it's time for us to get some justice.
Well, the other part of that too, there's a couple of documentaries they had about the OJ situation after the trial was done, and they talked about, they covered the whole history of African Americans in Los Angeles and their issues with the LA police for years and years before OJ's situation ever came up. And there's the Watts riots, there's Rodney King, so there were a lot of things that were building up to that as well.
Yeah, people forget about the Rodney King. The Rodney King beating by the Los Angeles police against Rodney King, that was in 91 and 92, and then you've got OJ piggybacking that in 94. And don't forget, those policemen were found not guilty that beat up Rodney King. So the wound was still fresh there. Now you had an African-American folk hero, a pop culture hero, accused of killing two white people, and suddenly the roles were switched. And like I said, we are still, I believe, living, because our racial divide was so obvious when that verdict was announced. We may have thought that race relations were getting better and maybe things were getting okay and things were moving along, but then when you saw that, you realized, no, this is a lingering problem in our country. And so that's why I was surprised that the OJ trial just kind of drifted away.
Well, like I said, I think there's so many other stories since then, whether it's political or worldwide, that have taken over. And again, like you said, it happened so long ago that for some people it's like it's in the past, what's going on right now, because that's how our news stories and our attention goes.
No, don't forget, it was called the trial of the century.
Yep. Well, the other point to bring up, Jim, and I remember this because, remember, the jury got that trial on a Friday. They only met a little bit then. And then that Monday, they only met for like 3 hours.
Right. They deliberated for 3 hours. Right. Oh, yeah. I mean.
And I remember my mom telling me, because I came home from work, and she had this sick look on her face, and she said, they've got a verdict. I said, who? She says, the OJ trial, the jury. And I said, wait a minute, they've had months and months of evidence and things to go over. Even OJ's lawyers, they all went out of town because they figured it would take a week or two before they'd come to a verdict. And again, I think as much as the verdict was a shock, the speed of them just saying, okay, we're done, we know what's going on, this is our verdict.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Yeah, it was. And I was just surprised that the news media did not spend more time and use it as a teaching moment. But like I said, that's the culture we live in today. Jim Tirano with you here at WGN Radio 720 AM, talking to Mick Kaler here in the Pop Culture Club. Mick, I got a text from somebody, and this is a really good point. I was saying how OJ was kind of the first reality television.
Right.
But in January of 94, again, think about 94. What a year that was. Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan.
Oh, yeah, the whole Olympic thing with the assault on Nancy Kerrigan.
Yeah, I mean, that was like a soap opera and a drama, too. I forgot about that.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Remember that when you were seeing that? You couldn't even believe what you were hearing, and that was, once again, No actors there. That was real life, where Tanya Harding's, was she married to?
Jeff Galooly. Jeff Galooly. And then he had a couple of his buddies that kind of made the move and assaulted Nancy Kerrigan to increase Tanya's chances of being placed better on the Olympic team. Yeah.
Yeah, they hit her on the knees with a pipe or something, right?
Right.
And then she wound up still skating. And then remember when Tanya Harding skated the next time, she complained that her skates weren't tied right.
Yeah, her lace was messed up, exactly. And, of course, that was spoofed on Seinfeld
right.
Not that long after that, too.
Oh, wow, I forgot about that. Yeah, I tell you, that's probably true. The Tanya Harding-Nancy Kerrigan thing was probably the first real-life crime soap opera before OJ. But once again, that was only 6 months later. What a year that was, 94. Wow, we had some crazy crimes going on.
Well, also, keep in mind, the Monday morning when we learned that OJ's wife had been murdered, a couple hours later is when Ryne Sandberg did his first retirement from the Cubs.
Oh, that was the same day?
Yeah. In fact, I was working at US 99, and our newswire was just going crazy that morning. And after learning about OJ's ex-wife being murdered, and a little bit later we learned that Ryne Sandberg is going to announce his retirement, I remember turning to my coworker, I said, wow, we got a crazy day going today,
don't
we?
Holy cow, 94, jam-packed. Holy cow.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one other thing I wanted to bring up about the OJ trial, Jim, I remember being, you know, the trial started in January of 95. In February of 95, I went to an Eagles concert at the United Center. They went into Don Henley's song, Dirty Laundry. This is like a month, not even a month into the trial. Don Henley goes up to the microphone and says, are you sick of this OJ trial yet? The whole place, you know, cheers, yes, right. They're sick of it. We had 8 more months to go before there was a verdict.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much, Mick, for taking some time here talking about some pop culture stuff in the Pop Culture Club. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, buddy, always.
Mick Kaler, known pop culture guru, and you can get a sample of some of his work every so often on the WGN Morning News with a parody song. So we will look for that as well. Thanks so much for taking some time out, Mick.
You bet, pal. Take care.
You know, every Sunday on Dean's Sunday Morning Show, he usually does a food segment. And while I am not the chef, per se, that Dean is, he's actually carved out a nice little side career as being not only an entertainment reporter, but also an on-air cook, thanks to COVID, during the COVID era there a few years ago when entertainment was kind of shut down. Dean did a smart thing and started to do a cooking segment, which has become very popular. I know he loves cooking, and so he really enjoys doing that as well. And so he's also always done a little cooking and food segment on the show here. So I wanted to stay into the Dean mode, give you some of the regular features of a Dean Richards show, as well as add a few little Elton Jim-isms along the way over the last 4 hours. So what I wanted to talk about today, I discovered this a few months ago in an airport lounge. Never heard or saw of this before. I have my miles on American. No, I'm not trying to promote anything, just letting you know. And my wife and I were traveling, and so I was in the American lounge. I'm not sure where it was. I don't know. I'm not sure where we saw this. But it was in the morning. And we walked in, and I see these little kind of, what are those things called? There's little white, oh man, I can't remember the word. I always forget this word. They're white. Okay, maybe you can help me with a text or a phone number. They're white little mini bowls that have ridges around them. A lot of times people will put like all their different ingredients in them. Ramekins, something like that. Is that the word, ramekin? I think it's called a ramekin. Am I wrong or right? Somebody let me know on the text or on the phone. Is it a ramekin? I think that's what it is. Anyway, you know, it's a small little mini bowl, if you will.
That's correct.
It is ramekin. Thank you, my friend. That's Patrick, our producer today. I knew I'd get it, but that word always, I don't know, for some reason, that I always have a mental block about ramekin. Maybe because I never really liked Rahm Emanuel as our mayor, but that's just a whole other subject. But anyway, so I saw this food in these little ramekins that were set up in the airport lounge, and I saw the little name tag by it, and it said overnight oats. And I'm like, what are overnight oats? I'd never seen these before. I never heard of them before. Now, I like to have breakfast, but I like a light breakfast. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, nothing really beats a nice scrambled eggs with hash browns and sausage. I mean, that's, you got to love that. But if I have that, I don't eat until like 9 o'clock at night because it's just like, whoa. I don't know how people used to eat that breakfast. And then 4 hours later, they would have a huge lunch. And then 5 hours after that, they'd have a huge dinner. I mean, and they didn't used to go to, and they didn't have health clubs either. I don't know how. That's why everybody died at 45, I guess. I don't know. But look, I love a nice big breakfast, but I don't have it all the time. So I like a light breakfast. And I really am a fan. I have come to appreciate the joys of oatmeal. I really like oatmeal. It's nice. It's quick. It's, you know, sometimes I don't really go for the instant oatmeal. Like, you know, the oatmeal that's in that little bag that you pour into the, you rip the bag and you put it in the thing and you put it in the microwave for 2 minutes. I love cream of wheat or like malt oatmeal. It takes long, but it's like when I was standing outside for the Bruce Springsteen concert for 12 hours. But then when I'm eating it, I'm glad I waited and took the time to make the malt oatmeal. And so I like to make the original oatmeal as well. But I really like oatmeal in that it's a nice, lighter breakfast. It still offers you some health benefits, too. They always say it's heart healthy. Everybody's concerned about that. Doesn't take as long to make. And it's very satisfying. My gosh, I got to tell you, one of my favorite oatmeals is at a hotel in Los Angeles. Oh, actually in Santa Monica, right on the beach in the place called Shudders. Way too expensive to stay there, believe me. But if you want to go to Shudders for their breakfast, it's fantastic in the restaurant they have there. They have the best steel cut oats that I've ever tasted with some fresh fruit like strawberries and raspberries and blueberries with those steel cut oats. Oh, I fell in love. I never heard of steel cut oats before I went to Shudders and had this oatmeal there. And then when we would stay there, we go to Santa Monica every so often. I mean, I'm always there at Shudders and I'm always ordering my steel cut oats. I have to get it. So I like an oatmeal with a little brown sugar. I'll throw in some fresh fruit if I have it. A little bananas, like I said, some raspberries, little blueberries. I can also do a strawberry. I'm not a huge strawberry fan, but I'll throw a strawberry in if it's hanging around. But I love, oh, man, you got to love the brown sugar in the oatmeal. Mm. But anyway, I discover these ramekins. Patrick tells me that's the right word. Filled with something called overnight oats. And I've never seen these. I never heard them. It looks like oatmeal. It sort of smells like oatmeal, if oatmeal has a smell. But it was also such a small little serving. It was perfect for a light breakfast. Of course, you know, when I saw these little ramekins, I'm like, okay, I got to take like seven of these things. Where am I going with this little ramekin? It's like, you know, two bites with a spoon. But I'm like, what are overnight oats? So I didn't want to take too many at one time at the beginning without first tasting them. But I have to tell you, I took my little ramekins of overnight oats back to my table. I just took two, just as a prep, as a starter, just to see if I liked them. And my gosh, I am a new fan of overnight oats. It's a great, quick little breakfast. Easy to make, healthy, tasty, natural. Put it this way, it tastes good and it's good for you. So how could you go wrong with that, right? That's what you want for breakfast. And also, I looked it up a little and it is healthy from the standpoint it's got good proteins, a healthy fat, calcium, fiber, complex carbohydrates, so it's a good energy food for the morning. That's what you want during the day. Like I said, you know, you have those big breakfasts, and they taste so good. Don't get me wrong. I love the sausage and the eggs and the omelets and all, but my gosh, you know, then you're going to get up and start to do things and walk around? Oh, it just weighs on you. So I like a nice, lighter breakfast that will give me that energy, and I found that overnight oats fills the bill. After this break, I will tell you how to make this delicious, quick, healthy breakfast. Overnight oats. So we have a controversy in our hand here right before the show ends. The pronunciation of, is it ramekin? Oh, now, Patrick, what you said someone called in?
Yeah, someone called and said she believes it's pronounced ramekin. So there's an E in the word, but you don't pronounce it.
Ah, I always heard ramekin, but she says it's ramekin.
I guess everybody has different ways of pronouncing things, I guess.
I wonder if I just slur it a little and just go ramekin.
Yeah, that's one of your Jim-isms you were talking
right,
about.
Right, exactly. Ramekin. This way I hit both sides of it there. I don't know. Maybe it is ramekin. I don't know. That sounds too quick to me. I always thought there was three syllables, ramekin, but we'll see. I'm looking at the text here. Somebody says, try savory oatmeal. I'm not sure what savory oatmeal is. Another person says that overnight oats is also called Swiss oatmeal. I didn't know that. That is weird. Cocoa wheats, someone says here, 815 says cocoa wheats are good too. Yes, I like a warm cereal. I'm a warm cereal guy. Don't get me wrong. I love cereal with milk, but I do like a warm cereal. I like a cream of wheat. I like a malt oatmeal and cocoa wheats too. I've never seen it in the stores. It's online all the time. I've never seen it, but apparently there is a chocolate version of malt oatmeal, which I've looked for and I could never find. I would think that would be really good. We put a little butter in the malt oatmeal. Oh. But anyway, we're talking about the joys of oatmeal and steel cut oats. Now, I was talking to Patrick here during the break. Patrick says that you have tasted the oats too, Patrick, right? He's not really. Could you get on there real quick? You have had overnight oats.
Yes, yeah, sorry, I got distracted. Yeah. Shawnee walked in.
Of course.
He's leaving for the day.
Oh.
Yeah, it was really good. I'd put like milk, brown sugar, a little bit of vanilla, some berries. Yeah, it was good.
Now, like you were saying, now the interesting thing about overnight oats is it's not warm like regular oatmeal.
Right, it's cold. I thought I would miss, because, you know, oatmeal, when I eat oatmeal, it's hot. That's one of the things you like about it. I thought it would be weird, but it was good. And like you said, it's like a kind of like a creamy, savory type of texture.
Yeah, it's you wouldn't think you would like cold oats, but I fell in love with it. I went back three times for more ramekins of the overnight oats, and my wife was like, well, you know, this has to be very easy to make. This can't be. Now, you were saying that maybe I'm slow to the show here. You've maybe had those about a year ago, and you think that maybe that the overnight oats became popular because of COVID and people were just hanging around without much to do and trying different things.
Yeah, I think this is just my personal theory, but I really think it gained popularity over COVID as like a TikTok trend, because that was whipped coffee was another thing that became really popular because of COVID. I think it's just one of those things. It was a trend, and now more people are aware of it, because I didn't, like you said, I hadn't tried it till pretty much over the last year or
so.
So
if you want to experience the taste explosion that I have been describing to you, called overnight oats, once again, what's so great about this, so easy, so fast. That's the thing. I don't have much patience. I will scramble eggs. I like a good omelet. I'll make some pancakes every so often, but the prep time for food, I just don't have the patience. And but that is something that's so great about these overnight oats. So here it is, really simple. Depending on how big of a serving size you want, and you can make some little modifications of this, but here's kind of the foundation of the overnight oats. And they really are overnight oats. The name does describe it. You could either use a half or one cup of milk, a half or one cup of oats, you know, Quaker oats, any kind of oats that come in that big tube, you know, that big giant container with the, you know, with the real oatmeal. I mean, I don't want, you know, fake oatmeal, the real oatmeal, the oats, or it says oats on it, rolled oats. You don't want the steel cut ones, actually, apparently, for some reason. You want the rolled oats. Some chia seeds you can add to this to give it a little texture. You can add some spices, like cinnamon, brown sugar, whatever you want to use. Also, as I said before, some fresh fruit, like bananas or blueberries or raspberries or blackberries or strawberries. But the key is the milk and the oats. And if you want it a little thicker, and I would, and some honey. Don't forget that, because that gives you a little sweetness there. So don't forget the honey. If you want it a little thicker, I prefer my overnight oats a little thicker. My wife had made them both ways, one time with just the milk, and then one time she added a cup of yogurt, probably Greek yogurt, a little thicker, to give it just a little more of a creamy kind of texture and a creamy kind of taste, and it holds the shape as opposed to it being a lot of looser. But that's all it is. Some yogurt, some milk, some oats, some honey, some chia seeds if you want, just for some texture, some spice, cinnamon, brown sugar, and whatever fresh fruit you like. You put that in a container, you seal it, you do it about 7 o'clock at night, and here's where the title comes in. You leave it in the refrigerator overnight. And in the morning, you have overnight oats. They're cold, they're creamy, yet firm. You've got the fruit in there, you've got the honey to give you the little sweetness, the yogurt there to give that creamy flavor, and you've got your favorite fruit. You can mix them. You could put all one fruit in there, all blueberries, all blackberries, all strawberries, or mix them up. I got to tell you, for a midday snack as well, or for a very quick and healthy and energizing breakfast, I don't think you can beat overnight oats. So that is my recommendation. I discovered those in the airport lounge. And I have now, my wife has made them three times at home. And I hope you're listening, because I could go maybe for some overnight oats tomorrow morning. I'm making myself hungry. So hopefully we still have the raspberries left over, and we could do a little raspberry version of overnight oats. But so that is my recommendation for you for a nice, energizing, healthy, quick, light breakfast in the morning, or as I said, a midday snack as well. You can't go wrong with overnight oats.
I'm the opposite of you. I like a big breakfast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you like
eggs,
what?
Potatoes.
Oh, I forgot
bacon.
About the potatoes. Yeah. You got to have the hash browns. You got to have the whole thing. No, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love that. But I don't know if I could do that, you know, 7 days a week.
Country fried steak, coffee.
Do you like chicken fried steak?
Oh, I love it.
Oh. With the biscuits and the gravy?
Yeah, with the gravy on top of it.
I traveled one time to a town called Tomball, Texas, because I saw some place called, was it Goodson's? I think it was called Goodson's, in this town just outside of Houston. And it looked like the greatest chicken fried steak. And so I went to a concert finally in Houston, and we went to Tomball, Texas. And it was delish. They had that, you know, that thick white gravy.
Yeah, the white gravy.
Oh,
now I'm hungry.
No kidding. Oh, it was so good with the biscuits. Oh, fantastic. So anyway, well, I'm looking at the clock here. We're winding down on time. I want to thank my guests. I apologize at the beginning of the show. If you were listening, Dr. Jeremy Silver, we had some phone problems with him, and we finally just had to stop the interview because his phone died on us four times. We were talking about sunscreen and sun exposure prevention, so I'm sorry for that, but hopefully we will be able to get he'll be back, and hopefully his line will be better next time. I also want to thank Eric Soderstrom from Ravinia, talking about their new 2024 season. And I want to thank Mick Kaler, who came on to the Pop Culture Club today to talk about some of the new topics going on. Patrick, never worked with you before. Now, you are here full-time, all the time, sometime?
Whoop. Sometimes. He's still figuring out the board. Yeah, I'm going to head over to work with Steve Dale, and then I'm here every Saturday morning with David Hochberg.
Oh, you're going to work with Steve right now?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Right,
look at you.
Show. Yep.
Oh, my goodness. You're a busy boy. My gosh. So you work every week with Steve?
Yep. But actually, this is my last show with him.
Oh,
so it's a farewell.
And then why? What are you doing after that?
I am taking over Dave Plyer's show on Friday nights.
Oh, there you go. Very nice.
So Friday night and then Saturday morning with David Hochberg.
Well, very good. That's Patrick Hennessy. So he's going to be working around here. Thank you for doing that for me as well, hitting the buttons. The show went very smooth. Thanks to our friend out there in the hallway, big Bobby Ferguson, the engineer extraordinaire. Thank you, Toe. So good to see you again, Bob. Anyway, thanks for listening. Dane will be back next week with all of his usual topics and segments. Also, thanks to Dave Schwann and to Andy Mazur. And don't forget, at 3 o'clock, Andy will be joined by Dan Hampton and Ed Obradovich for a special post-Bears draft extravaganza from 3 to 5. So you'll certainly want to listen to that. Get a little pre-season Bears talk from Hamp and OB. And as Patrick said, at 1 o'clock right after the news, Steve Deo will be doing his show from 1 to 3. I'm always, always very honored and privileged to sit in here for Dean. I know Dean has a great loyal audience, and I appreciate you tuning in today. Hope you enjoyed what you heard, and hopefully we'll be back here soon talking to you either alone or when Dean invites me in. So thank you very much. Hope you had a good time. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. Hopefully we'll talk soon. Have a good Sunday.